gift of ice and wind. A freezing zap at her elbow had her falling back against the tree. The magic bit her cheek now. Magic, attacking her. The wildfire exploded in a wall of blue flame, rushing for Rowan, engulfing the trees, the world, herself, until it vanished, sucked out into nothing, along with the air she was breathing. Selena dropped to her knees, as she clutched at her neck as if she could claw open an airway for herself. Rowan's boots appeared in the field of her vision. He'd pulled the air out, suffocated her fire. Such power, such control. Maeve had not given her an instructor with similar abilities. She'd instead sent someone with power capable of smothering her fire. Someone who wouldn't mind doing it should she become a threat. Air rushed down her throat in a whoosh. She gasped it down in greedy gulps, hardly registering the agony as she shifted back into her mortal form. The world going quiet and dull again.
Does your lover know what you are?
A cold question. She lifted her head, not caring how he'd found out. He knows everything. Not entirely true. His eyes flickered. With what emotion, she couldn't tell.
I won't be biting you again,
he said. And she wondered just what he'd tasted in her blood. She growled, but the sound was muted, fangless. Even if it's the only way to get me to shift? He walked uphill, to the ridge.
You don't bite the women of other males.
She heard, more than felt, something die from her voice, as she said, We're not together. Not anymore. I let him go before I came here. He looked over his shoulder.
Why?
Flat. Bored. But still slightly curious. What did she care if he knew? She'd curled her hand into a fist in her lap, her knuckles white. Every time she glanced at the ring, rubbed it, caught it gleaming, it punched a hole right through her. She should take the damn thing off. But she knew she wouldn't, if only because that near constant agony felt deserved. Because he's safer if he's as repulsed by me as you are.
At least you've already learned one lesson.
When she cocked her head, he said,
The people you love are just weapons that will be used against you.
She didn't want to recall how Nehemia had been used. Had used herself, against her, to force her to act. Wanted to pretend she wasn't starting to forget what Nehemia had looked like.
Shift again, Rowan ordered, jerking his chin at her. This time, try to...
She was forgetting what Nehemia looked like. The shade of her eyes, the curve of her lips, the smell of her, her laugh. The roaring in Selena's head went quiet, silenced by that familiar nothingness. Do not let that light go out. But Selena didn't know how to stop it. The one person she could have told, who might have understood. She was buried in an unadorned grave, so far from the sun-warmed soil that she had loved. Rowan gripped her by the shoulders.
Are you listening?
She gave him a bored stare, even as his fingers dug into her skin. Why don't you just bite me again?
Why don't I give you the lashing you deserve?
He looked so dead set on it that she blinked.
If you ever take a whip to me, I will skin you alive.
He let go of her and stalked around the clearing, a predator assessing its prey.
If you don't shift again, you're pulling double duty in the kitchens for the next week.
Fine. At least working in the kitchens had some quantifiable results. At least in the kitchens, she could tell up from down and knew what she was doing. But this? This promise she'd made? The bargain she'd struck with Maeve? She'd been a fool.
Rowan paused his stalking. You're worthless.
Tell me something I don't know.
He went on. You would probably have been more useful to the world if you'd actually died 10 years ago. She just looked him in the eye and said, I'm leaving. Rowan didn't stop her as she returned to the fortress and packed. It took all of a minute, as she hadn't even unloaded her satchel and had no weapons left. She supposed she could have ripped the fortress apart to find where Rowan had stashed them, or stolen them from the demi-fae, but both would require time and bring more attention than she wanted. She didn't talk to anyone as she walked out. She'd find another way to learn about the word keys and destroy the King of Otterlin and free Eelway. If she kept going like this, she'd have nothing left inside to fight with. She'd marked the paths they'd taken on the way in. But as she entered the tree-covered slopes, she mostly relied on the position of the cloud-veiled sun to navigate. She'd make the trip back, find food along the way, and figure out something else. This had been a fool's errand from the start. At least she hadn't been too long delayed, though she might now have to be quicker about finding the answers she needed and... Is this what you do? Run away when things get hard? Rowan was standing between two trees directly in her path, having undoubtedly flown here. She brushed past him, her legs burning with the downhill walk. You're free of your obligation to train me, so I have nothing more to say to you, and you have nothing more to say to me. Do us both a favor and go to hell. A growl.
Have you ever had to fight for anything in your life?
She let out a low, bitter laugh and walked faster, veering westward, not caring about the direction as much as getting away from him. But he kept up easily, his long, heavily muscled legs devouring the mossy ground.
You're proving me right with every step you take.
I don't care.
I don't know what you want from Maeve, what answers you're looking for, but you...
You don't know what I want from her?
It was more of a shout than a question.
How about saving the world from the King of Otterlin?
Why bother? Maybe the world's not worth saving.
She knew he meant it, too. Those lifeless eyes spoke volumes.
Because I made a promise. A promise to my friend that I would see her kingdom freed.
She shoved her scarred palm into his face.
I made an unbreakable vow. And you, and Maeve, and all you goddamned bastards are getting in the way of that.
She went off down the hillside again. He followed.
And what of your own people? What of your own kingdom?
They are better off without me, just as you said.
His tattoo scrunched as he snarled.
So you'd save another land, but not yours. Why can't your friend save her own kingdom?
Because she is dead!
She screamed the last word so loudly it burned in her throat.
Because she is dead, and I am left with my worthless life.
He merely stared at her with that animal stillness. When she walked away, he didn't come after her. She lost track of how far she walked and in what direction she traveled. She didn't really care. She hadn't spoken the words, "She is dead," since the day after Nehemia had been taken from her. But she was dead, and Selena missed her. Night swept in earlier due to the cloud cover, the temperature plummeting as thunder grumbled in the distance. She made weapons as she went, finding a sharp stone to whittle down branches into rudimentary spears. The longer one she used as a walking stick, and though they were little more than stakes, she told herself the two short ones were daggers. Better than nothing. Each step was heavier than the last, and she had enough of a sense of self-preservation left to start looking for a place to spend the night.
It was almost dark when she found a decent spot. A shallow cave in the side of a granite ledge. She swiftly gathered enough wood for a fire. The irony of it wasn't wasted on her. If she had any control over her magic... She shut down that thought before it finished. She hadn't made a fire in years, so it took a few tries, but it worked. Just as thunder cracked above her little cave, and the skies opened up. She was hungry, and thankfully found some apples at the bottom of her satchel, along with old Tegya from Verez that was still edible, if hard to chew. After she ate as much of it as she could stand, she pulled her cloak around herself and nestled into the side of the cave. She didn't fail to notice the small, glowing eyes that gathered, peering through the brambles or over boulders or around trees. None of them had bothered her since that first night, and they didn't come closer. Her instincts, warped as they had felt these last few weeks, didn't raise any alarms either. So she didn't tell them off, and didn't really mind them at all. With the fire and the pounding rain, it was almost cozy, not like her freezing room. Though she was exhausted, she felt somewhat clear-headed, almost like herself again with her makeshift weapons. She'd made a smart choice to leave. "Do what needs to be done," Elena had told her. Well, she'd needed to leave before Rowan shredded her into so many pieces that she would never stand a chance of putting herself back together. Tomorrow, she'd start over. She'd spotted what looked like a crumbling, forgotten road that she could follow downhill. As long as she kept going toward the plains, she could find her way back to the coast and come up with a new plan as she went. It was good she had left. Exhaustion hit her so thoroughly that she was asleep moments after she sprawled beside the fire, one hand clasped around her spear. She probably would have dozed until dawn, had a sudden silence not jerked her awake. Chapter 22. Selena's fire was still crackling, the rain still pounding beyond the cave mouth, but the forest had gone quiet. Those little watching eyes had vanished. She uncoiled to her feet, spear in one hand and a stake in the other, and crept to the narrow cave entrance. With the rain and the fire, she couldn't make out anything. But every hair on her body was standing, and a growing reek was slithering in from the forest beyond. Like leather and carrion, different from what she'd whiffed at the barrows. Older and earthier and hungrier. Suddenly, the fire seemed like the stupidest thing she had ever done. No fires. That had been Rowan's only rule while trekking to the fortress. And they'd stayed off the roads, veering away entirely from the forgotten, overgrown ones. Ones like the path she'd spied nearby. The silence deepened. She slipped into the drenched forest, stubbing her toes on rocks and roots as her eyes adjusted to the dark. But she kept moving ahead, curving down and away from the ancient path. She'd made it far enough that her cave was little more than a glow on the hill above, a flicker of light illuminating the trees. A god's damned beacon. She angled her stake and spear into better positions, about to continue on when lightning flashed. Three tall, lanky silhouettes lurked in front of her cave. Though they stood like humans, she knew, deep in her bones from some collective mortal memory, that they were not. They were not Fae, either. With expert quiet, she took another step, then another. They were still poking around the cave entrance, taller than men. Neither male nor female. "Skinwalkers are on the prowl," Rowan had warned that first day they'd trained. "Searching for human pelts to bring back to their caves." She had been too dazed to ask or care, But now that carelessness, that wallowing, was going to get her killed, skinned. Wendlin, land of nightmares made flesh, where legends roamed the earth. Despite years of stealth training, every step felt like a snap, her breathing too loud. Thunder grumbled, and she used the cover of the sound to take a few bounding steps. She stopped behind another tree, breathing as quietly as she could, and peering around it to survey the hillside behind her. Lightning flashed again. The three figures were gone, but the leathery, rancid smell swarmed all around her now. Human pelts. She eyed the tree she'd ducked behind. The trunk was too slick with moss and rain to scale, the branches too high. The other trees weren't any better. And what good was being stuck up a tree in a lightning storm? She darted to the next tree, carefully avoiding any sticks or leaves, cursing silently at the slowness of her pace and, damn it all to hell. She burst into a run, the mossy earth treacherous underfoot. She could make out the trees, some larger rocks, but the slope was steep. She kept her feet under her, even as undergrowth cracked behind, faster and faster. She didn't dare take her focus off the trees and rocks as she hurtled down the slope, desperate for any flat ground. Perhaps their hunting territory ended somewhere. Perhaps she could outrun them until dawn. She veered eastward, still going downhill, and grabbed onto a trunk to swing herself around, almost losing her balance as she slammed into something hard and unyielding. She slashed with her stake, only to be grabbed by two massive hands. Her wrists sang in agony as the fingers squeezed hard enough that she couldn't stab either weapon into her captor. She twisted, bringing up a foot to smash into her assailant, and caught a flash of fangs before... not fangs. Teeth. And there was no gleam of flesh pelts, only silver hair, shining with rain. Rowan dragged her against him, pressing them into what appeared to be a hollowed-out tree. She kept her panting quiet, but breathing didn't become any easier when Rowan gripped her by the shoulders and put his mouth to her ear. The crashing footsteps had stopped.
You are going to listen to every word I say.
Rowan's voice was softer than the rain outside.
Or else you are going to die tonight. Do you understand?
She nodded. He let go, only to draw his sword and a wicked-looking hatchet.
Your survival depends entirely on you.
The smell was growing again.
You need to shift now, or your mortal slowness will kill you.
She stiffened, but reached in, feeling for some thread of power. There was nothing. There had to be some trigger, some place inside her where she could command it. A slow, shrieking sound of stone on metal sounded through the rain. Then another. And another. They were sharpening their blades. Your magic...
They do not breathe, so have no airways to cut off. Ice would slow them, not stop them. My wind is already blowing our scent away from them, but not for long. Shift, Aelin.
Aelin. It was not a test, not some elaborate trick. The skinwalkers did not need air. Rowan's tattoo shone as lightning filled their little hiding spot.
We are going to have to run in a moment. What form you take when we do will determine our fates. So breathe and shift.
Though every instinct screamed against it, she closed her eyes, took a breath, then another. Her lungs opened, full of cool, soothing air, and she wondered if Rowan was helping with that, too. He was helping, and he was willing to meet a horrible fate in order to keep her alive. He hadn't left her alone. She hadn't been alone. There was a muffled curse, and Rowan slammed his body against hers, as if he could somehow shield her. No, not shield her. Cover her. The flash of light. She barely registered the pain, if only because the moment her face senses snapped into place, she had to shove a hand against her own mouth to keep from retching. Oh, gods, the festering smell of them. Worse than any corpse she'd ever dealt with. With her delicately pointed ears, she could hear them now. Each step they took as the three of them systematically made their way down the hill. They spoke in low, strange voices, at once male and female, all ravenous.
There are two of them now,
one hissed. She didn't want to know what power it wielded to allow it to speak when it had no airways.
The female joined the female. I want him. He smells of storm winds and steel.
Selena gagged as the smell shoved down her throat.
The female will bring back with us. Dawn's too close. Then we can take our time peeling her apart.
Rowan eased off her and said quietly, not needing to be near for her to hear while he assessed the forest beyond.
There is a swift river a third of a mile east, at the base of a large cliff.
He didn't look at her as he extended two long daggers, and she didn't nod her thanks as she silently discarded her makeshift weapons and gripped the ivory hilts.
When I say run, you run like hell. Step where I step, and don't turn around for any reason. If we are separated, run straight. You'll hear the river.
Order after order. A commander on the battlefield, solid and deadly. He peered out of the tree. The smell was nearly overpowering now, swarming from every angle.
If they catch you, you cannot kill them, not with a mortal weapon. Your best option is to fight until you can get free and run. Understand?
She gave another nod. Breathing was hard again, and the rain was now torrential.
On my mark,
Rowan said, smelling and hearing things that were lost even to her heightened senses.
Steady.
She sank onto her haunches as Rowan did the same.
Come out, come out,
one of them hissed. So close it could have been inside the tree with them. There was a sudden rustling in the brush to the west, almost as if two people were running. Instantly, the reek of the skinwalkers lessened as they raced after the cracking branches and leaves that Rowan's wind led in the other direction.
Now,
Rowan hissed, and burst out of the tree. Selena ran, or tried to. Even with her sharpened vision, the brush and stones and trees proved a hindrance. Rowan raced toward the rising roar of the river, swollen from the spring rains. His pace slower than she'd expected, but he was slowing for her. Because this fey body was different, and she was adjusting wrong, and she slipped. But a hand was at her elbow, keeping her upright.
Faster,
was all he said. And as soon as she'd found her footing, he was off again, shooting through the trees like a mountain cat. It took all of a minute before the force of that smell gnawed on her heels and the snapping of the brush closed in. But she wouldn't take her eyes off Rowan and the brightening ahead. The end of the tree line, not much farther until they could jump, and a fourth skinwalker leapt out of where it had somehow been lurking undetected in the brush. It lunged for Rowan in a flash of leathery long limbs marred with countless scars. No, not scars. Stitches. The stitches holding its various hides together. She shouted as the skinwalker pounced, but Rowan didn't falter a step as he ducked and twirled with inhuman speed, slashing down with his sword and viciously slicing with the hatchet. The skinwalker's arm severed at the same moment its head toppled off its neck. She might have marveled at the way he moved, the way he killed, but Rowan didn't stop sprinting, so Selena raced after him, glancing once at the body the Fey warrior had left in pieces. sagging bits of leather on the wet leaves, like discarded clothes, but still twitching and rustling, as if waiting for someone to stitch it back together. She ran faster, Rowan still bounding ahead. The skinwalkers closed in from behind, shrieking with rage. Then they fell silent until...
You think the river can save you?
One of them panted, letting out a laugh that raked along her bones.
You think if we get wet, we'll lose our form? I have worn the skins of fishes when mortals were scarce, female.
She had an image, then, of the chaos waiting in that river. A flipping and near drowning and dizziness, and something pulling her down, down, down to the still bottom.
Rowan!
She breathed. But he was already gone, his massive body hurtling straight off the cliff edge in a mighty leap. There was no stopping the pursuit behind her. The skinwalkers were going to jump with them, and there would be nothing they could do to kill them, no mortal weapon they could use. A well ripped open inside of her, vast and unyielding and horrible. Rowan had claimed no mortal weapon could kill them, but what of immortal ones? Selena broke through the line of trees, sprinting for the ledge that jutted out, bare granite beneath her, as she threw her strength into her legs, her lungs, her arms, and jumped. As she plummeted, she twisted to face the cliff, to face them. They were no more than three lean bodies leaping into the rainy night, shrieking with primal, triumphant, anticipated pleasure. Shift! Was the only warning she gave Rowan. There was a flash of light to tell her he'd obeyed. Then she ripped everything from that well inside her, ripped it out with both hands and her entire raging, hopeless heart. As she fell, hair whipping her face, Selena thrust her hands toward the skinwalkers.
Surprise, she hissed.
The world erupted in blue wildfire. Selena shuddered on the riverbank, from cold and exhaustion and terror. Terror at the skinwalkers, and terror at what she had done. His clothes dry thanks to shifting, Rowan stood a few feet away, monitoring the smoldering cliffs upriver. She'd incinerated the skinwalkers. They hadn't even had time to scream. She hunched over her knees, arms wrapped around herself. The forest was burning on either side of the river, a radius that she didn't have the nerve to measure. It was a weapon, her power. A different sort of weapon than blades or arrows or her hands. A curse. It took several attempts, but at last she spoke.
Can you put it out?
You could, if you tried.
When she didn't respond, he said,
I'm almost done.
In a moment, the flames nearest the cliffs went out. How long had he been working to suffocate them?
We don't need something else attracted to your fires.
She might have bothered to respond to the jab, but she was too tired and cold. The rain filled the world, and for a while, silence reigned.
Why is my shifting so vital?
She asked at last.
Because it terrifies you,
he said.
Mastering it is the first step toward learning to control your power. Without that control, with a blast like that, you could easily have burnt yourself out.
What do you mean? Another stormy look.
When you access your power, what does it feel like?
She considered. A well? She said. The magic feels like a well.
Have you felt the bottom of it?
Is there a bottom? She prayed there was.
All magic has a bottom, a breaking point. For those with weaker gifts, it's easily depleted and easily refilled. They can access most of their power at once. But for those with stronger gifts, it can take hours to hit the bottom, to summon their powers at full strength.
How long does it take you?
A full day.
She jolted.
Before battle, we take the time, so that when we walk onto the killing field, we can be at our strongest. You can do other things at the same time, but some part of you is down in there, pulling up more and more, until you reach the bottom.
And when you pull it all out, it just releases in some giant wave?
If I want it to. I can release it in smaller bursts and go on for a while. But it can be hard to hold it back. People sometimes can't tell friend from foe when they're handling that much magic.
When she'd drawn her power on the other side of the portal months ago, she'd felt that lack of control. Known she was almost as likely to hurt Kaol as she was to hurt the demon he was facing. How long does it take you to recover?
Days. A week, depending on how I use the power and whether I drained every last drop. Some make the mistake of trying to take more before they're ready, or holding on for too long, and they either burn out their minds or just burn up altogether. Your shaking isn't just from the river, you know. It's your body's way of telling you not to do that again.
Because of the iron in our blood, pushing against the magic?
That's how our enemies will sometimes try to fight against us if they don't have magic. Iron everything.
He must have seen her brows rise, because he added,
I was captured once, while on a campaign in the East, in a kingdom that doesn't exist anymore. They had me shackled head to toe in iron to keep me from choking the air out of their lungs.
She let out a low whistle. Were you tortured?
2 weeks on their tables before my men rescued me.
He unbuckled his vambrace and pushed back the sleeve of his right arm, revealing a thick, wicked scar curving around his forearm and elbow.
Cut me open bit by bit, then took the bones here and—
I can see very well what happened, and know exactly how it's done, she said, stomach tightening. Not at the injury, but Sam.
Sam had been strapped to a table, cut open and broken by one of the most sadistic killers she'd ever known. Was it you?
Rowan said quietly, but not gently.
Or someone else?
I was too late. He didn't survive. Again, silence fell, and she cursed herself for a fool for telling him. But then she said hoarsely, Thank you for saving me. A slight shrug, barely a movement at all, as if her gratitude were harder to endure than her hatred and reticence.
I am bound by an unbreakable blood oath to my queen, so I had no choice but to ensure you didn't die.
A bit of that earlier heaviness settled in her veins again.
But,
he went on,
I would not have left anyone to a fate at the hands of the Skinwalkers.
A warning would have been nice.
I said they were on the loose weeks ago, but even if I'd warned you today, you would not have listened.
It was true. She shivered again, this time so violently that her body shifted back, a flash of light and pain. If she'd thought she was cold in her fey body, it was nothing compared to the cold of being human again.
What was the trigger when you shifted earlier?
He asked, as if this moment were a reprieve from the real world, where the freezing storm and the surging river could muffle their words from the gods. She rubbed at her arms, desperate for any kind of warmth. It was nothing. His silence demanded information for information. A fair trade. She sighed. Let's just say it was fear and necessity and impressively deep-rooted survival instincts.
You didn't lose control immediately upon shifting. When you finally used your magic, your clothes didn't burn. Neither did your hair. And the daggers didn't melt.
As if just now remembering that she still had them, he swiped them from her. He was right. The magic hadn't swarmed her the moment she'd shifted, and even in the explosion that had spread out in every direction, she'd had enough control to preserve herself. Not a single hair had burned.
"Why was it different this time?"
he pressed. "Because I didn't want you to die to save me," she admitted.
"Would you have shifted to save yourself?"
"Your opinion of me is pretty much identical to my own, so you know the answer." He was quiet for long enough that she wondered if he was piecing the bits of her together.
"You're not leaving,"
Rowan said at last, arms crossed.
"I'm not letting you off double duty in the kitchens, but you're not leaving."
"Why?"
He unfastened his cloak. "Because I said so, that's why."
And she might have told him it was the worst God's damned reason she had ever heard, and that he was an arrogant prick, had he not tossed her his cloak, dry and warm. Then he dropped his jacket in her lap, too. When he turned to go back to the fortress, she followed him. Chapter 23. For the past week, not much had changed for Manon and the Blackbeaks. They still flew daily to master the wyverns, and still managed to avoid outright war in the mess hall twice a day. The Yellowlegs' heir tried to rile Manon whenever she could, but Manon paid her no more attention than she would a gnat buzzing about her head. All that changed the day of the selection, when the heirs and their covens chose their mounts. With 3 covens plus 3 matrons, there were 42 witches crowded around the training pit in the Northern Fang. Handlers rushed about below the viewing platform, readying themselves. The wyverns would be brought out one by one, and, using the bait beasts, would show off their qualities. Like the other witches, Manon had been sneaking by the cages every day. She still wanted Titus. Wanted was a mortal word. Titus was hers, and if it came down to it, she'd disembowel any witch who challenged her. She'd sharpened her nails this morning in anticipation of it. All of the 13 had. Claims would be settled in a civilized manner, however. The 3 matrons would draw sticks if more than one claim was made on a mount. When it came to Titus, Manon knew precisely who would vie for him. Iskra and Petra, the yellow legs and blue blood heirs. She'd seen them both watching him with hungry eyes. Had Manon gotten her way, they would have fought for him in the sparring ring. She'd even suggested as much to her grandmother, but was told they didn't need to quarrel amongst themselves any more than necessary. It would be luck of the draw. That didn't sit well with Manon, who stood along the open edge of the platform, Asterin flanking her. Her edginess only sharpened as the heavy grate lifted at the back of the pit. The bait beast was already chained to the blood-stained wall, a broken, scarred wyvern, half the size of the bull's, his wings tucked in tight. From the platform, she could see that the venomous spikes in his tail had been sawn off to keep him from defending himself against the invaluable mounts. The bait beast lowered his head as the gate groaned open, and the first wyvern was paraded in on tight chains held by very pale-faced men. They darted back as soon as the beast was through, dodging that deadly tail, and the grate shut behind them. Manon loosed a breath. It wasn't Titus, but one of the medium-sized bulls. 3 sentinels stepped forward to claim him, but the blue-blood matron, Cressida, held up a hand.
"Let us see him in action first."
One of the men whistled sharply. The wyvern turned on the bait beast. Teeth and scales and claws, so fast and vicious that even Manon held her breath. Chained as he was, the bait beast didn't stand a chance and was pinned within a second, massive jaws holding down his neck. One command, one whistle, and the wyvern would snap it. But the man let out a lower note whistle, and the bull backed off. Another whistle, and he sat on his haunches. Two more sentinels stepped forward. Five in the running. Cressida held out a fistful of twigs to the contenders. It went to the blue blood sentinel, who grinned at the others, then down at her wyvern as it was led back into the tunnel. The bait beast, bleeding from his side, heaved himself into the shadows by the wall, waiting for the next assault. One after another, the wyverns were brought out, attacking with swift, wicked force, and one by one, the sentinels claimed them. No Titus. Not yet. She had a feeling the matrons were drawing this out as some test, to see how well their heirs could control themselves while waiting for the best mounts, to see who would hold out longest. Manon kept one eye on the beasts and another one on the other heirs, who watched her in turn as each wyvern was paraded. Yet the first truly enormous female had Petra, the blue-blood heir, stepping forward. The female was nearly Titus's size, and wound up taking a chunk out of the bait beast's flank before the trainers could get her to stop. Wild, unpredictable, lethal, magnificent. No one challenged the blue-blood heir. Petra's mother only gave her a nod, as though they had already known what mount she desired. Asterin took the fiercest stealth wyvern that came along, a cunning-eyed female. Her cousin had always been the best at scouting, and after a talk with Manon and the other sentinels that went long into the night, it had been decided that Asterin would continue that role in the 13's new duties. So when the pale blue female was presented, Asterin claimed her, her eyes promising such brutality to anyone who got in her way that they practically glowed. No one dared challenge her. Manon was watching the tunnel entrance when she smelled the myrrh and rosemary scent of the blue blood air beside her. Asterin snarled a soft warning.
"Waiting for Titus, aren't you?"
Petra murmured, eyes also on the tunnel. "And if I am?" Manon asked.
"I'd rather have you with him than Iskra."
The witch's serene face was unreadable.
"So would I."
She wasn't sure what exactly, but the conversation meant something. Clearly, seeing them quietly talking meant something to everyone else, too. Especially Iskra, who sauntered over to Manon's other side.
"Plotting already?"
The blue blood heir lifted her chin.
"I think Titus would make a good mount for Manon."
A line in the sand, Manon thought. What had the blue blood matron told Petra about her? What schemes was she hatching? Iskra's mouth twisted into a half grin.
"We'll see what the three-faced mother has to say."
Manon might have said something back, but then Titus thundered out. As it had every other time, the breath went out of her at his sheer size and viciousness. The men had barely scrambled back through the gate before Titus whirled, snapping for them. They'd made only a few successful runs with him, she'd been told. Yet under the right rider, he'd fully break. Titus didn't wait for the whistle before he wheeled on the bait beast, striking with his barbed tail. The chained beast ducked with surprising swiftness, as if he'd sensed the bull's attack, and Titus's tail embedded itself in the stone. Debris rained on the bait beast, and as he cringed back, Titus struck again, and again. Chained to the wall, the bait beast could do nothing. The man whistled, but Titus kept at it. He moved with the fluid grace of untamed savagery. The bait beast yelped, and Manon could have sworn the blue blood heir flinched. She'd never heard a cry of pain from any of the wyverns, yet as Titus sank back on his haunches, she saw where he'd struck. Right atop the earlier wound in the bait beast's flank. As if Titus knew where to hit to inflict the most agony. She knew they were intelligent, but how intelligent? The man whistled again, and a whip sounded. Titus just kept pacing in front of the bait beast, contemplating how he would strike. Not out of strategy. No. He wanted to savor it. To taunt. A shiver of delight went down Manon's spine. Riding a beast like Titus, ripping apart her enemies with him.
If you want him so badly, Iskra whispered,
and Manon realized she was still standing beside her, now only a step away.
Why don't you go get him?
And before Manon could move, before anyone could, because they were all enthralled by that glorious beast, iron claws shoved into her back. Astrin's shout echoed, but Manon was falling, plunging the 40 feet right into the stone pit. She twisted, colliding with a small, crumbling ledge jutting from the wall. It slowed her fall and saved her life, but she kept going until she slammed into the ground, her ankle wrenching. Cries came from above, but Manon didn't look up. If she had, she might have seen Astrin tackle Iskra, claws and teeth out. She might have seen her grandmother give the order that no one was to jump into the pit. But Manon wasn't looking at them. Titus turned toward her. The wyvern stood between her and the gate, where the men were rushing to and fro, as if trying to decide whether they should risk saving her or wait until she was carrion. Titus's tail lashed back and forth, his dark eyes pinned on her. Manon drew Windcleaver. It was a dagger compared to the mass of him. She had to get to that gate. She stared him down. Titus settled onto his haunches, preparing to attack. He knew where the gate was, too, and what it meant for her. His prey. Not rider or mistress, but prey. The witches had gone silent. The men at the gate and upper platforms had gone silent. Manon rotated her sword. Titus lunged. She had to roll to avoid his mouth, and was up in a second, sprinting like hell for that gate. Her ankle throbbed, and she limped, swallowing her scream of pain. Titus turned, fast as a spring stream down a mountainside, and as she hurtled for the gate, he struck with his tail. Manon had enough sense to whirl to avoid the venomous barbs, but she caught an upper edge of the tail in the side and went flying, Windcleaver wrenching from her grip. She hit the dirt near the opposite wall and slid, face scraping on the rocks. Her ribs bleated in agony as she scrambled into a sitting position and gauged the distance between herself and the sword and Titus. But Titus was hesitating. His eyes lifted behind her, above her, to darkness embrace her. She'd forgotten about the bait beast. The creature chained behind her, so close she could smell the carrion in his breath. Titus's stare was a command for the bait beast to stand down, to let him eat Manon. Manon dared a glance over her shoulder, to the sword in the shadows, so close to the chained anchor of the bait beast. She might have risked it if the beast wasn't there, if he wasn't looking dead at her, looking at her like she was not prey. Titus growled a territorial warning at the bait beast, again, so loud she could feel it in every bone. Instead, the bait beast, small as he was gazing at her with something like rage and determination. Emotion, she might have called it. Hunger, but not for her. No, she realized, as the beast lifted its black gaze to Titus, letting out a low snarl in response. Not submissive in the least, that sound. A threat. A promise. The bait beast wanted a shot at Titus. Allies. If only for this moment. Again, Manon felt that ebb and flow in the world, that invisible current that some called fate and some called the loom of the three-faced goddess. Titus roared his final threat. Manon twisted to her feet and ran. Every step made stars flash, and the ground shook as Titus barreled after her, willing to tear her through the bait beast to kill her if necessary. Manon scooped up her sword and whirled, bringing it down upon the thick, rusted chain with every bit of strength left in her. Wind Cleaver, they called her blade. Now they would call it Iron Cleaver. The chain snapped free as Titus leapt for her. Titus didn't see it coming, and there was something like shock in his eyes as the bait beast tackled him and they rolled. Titus was twice its size and uninjured, and Manon didn't wait to see the outcome before she took off for the tunnel, where the men were frantically lifting the grate. But then a boom and a shocked murmur sounded, and Manon dared one look, in time to see the wyverns leap apart and the bait beast strike again. The blow from that scarred, useless tail was so strong, Titus's head slammed into the dirt. As Titus surged to his legs, the bait beast fainted with its tail and made a swipe with jagged claws that had Titus roaring in pain. Manon froze, barely 15 feet from the gate. The wyverns circled each other, wings scraping against the ground. It should have been a joke. And yet the bait beast wouldn't stand down, despite the limp, despite the scars and the blood. Titus went right for the throat with no warning growl. The bait beast's tail connected with Titus's head. Titus reeled back, but then lunged, jaws and tail snapping. Once those barbs got into the flesh of the bait beast, it would be done. The bait beast dodged the tail by slamming its own down atop it, but couldn't escape the jaws that latched onto its neck. Over. It should be over. The bait beast thrashed, but couldn't get free. Manon knew she should run. Others were shouting. She had been born without sympathy or mercy or kindness. She didn't care which one of them lived or died, so long as she escaped. But that current was still flowing. Flowing toward the fight, not away from it. And she owed the bait beast a life debt. So Manon did the most foolish thing she'd ever done in her long, wicked life. She ran for Titus and brought Windcleaver down upon his tail. She severed clean through flesh and bone, and Titus roared, releasing his prey. The stump of his tail lashed at her, and Manon took it right in the stomach, the air knocked out of her before she even hit the ground. When she raised herself, she saw the final lunge that ended it. Throat exposed by his bellow of pain, Titus didn't stand a chance as the bait beast pounced and closed its jaws around that mighty neck. Titus had one last thrash, one final attempt to pry himself free. The bait beast held firm, as though he'd been waiting for weeks or months or years. He clamped down and wrenched his head away, taking Titus's throat with him. Silence fell, as if the world itself stopped when Titus's body crashed to the ground, black blood spilling everywhere. Manon stood absolutely still. Slowly, the bait beast lifted its head from the carcass, Titus's blood dripping from his maw. Their eyes met. People were shouting at her to run, and the gate groaned open. But Manon stared into those black eyes, one of them horribly scarred but intact. He took a step, then another toward her. Manon held her ground. It was impossible. Impossible. Titus was twice his size, twice his weight, and had years of training. The bait beast had trounced him. Not because he was bigger or stronger, but because he wanted it more. Titus had been a brute and a killer, yet this wyvern before her, he was a warrior. Men were rushing in with spears and swords and whips, and the bait beast growled. Manon held up a hand, and again the world stopped. Manon, eyes still upon the beast, said, "He's mine." He had saved her life. Not by coincidence, but by choice. He'd felt the current running between them too.
"What?"
her grandmother barked from above. Manon found herself walking toward the wyvern and stopped with not 5 feet between them.
"He's mine,"
Manon said, taking in the scars, the limp, the burning life in those eyes. The witch and the wyvern looked at each other for a moment that lasted for a heartbeat, that lasted for eternity.
"You're mine,"
Manon said to him. The wyvern blinked at her, Titus's blood still dripping from his cracked and broken teeth. And Manon had the feeling that he had come to the same decision. Perhaps he had known long before tonight, and his fight with Titus hadn't been so much about survival as it had been a challenge to claim her. As his rider, as his mistress, as his. Manon named her wyvern Abraxos, after the ancient serpent who held the world between his coils at the behest of the three-faced goddess. And that was about the only pleasant thing that happened that night. When she'd returned to the others, Abraxos taken away for cleaning and mending, and Titus's carcass hauled off by 30 men, Manon had stared down each and every witch who dared meet her eyes. The Yellowleg's heir was being held by Asterin in front of the matrons. Manon gazed at Iskra for a long moment before she simply said, "Looks like I lost my footing." Iskra steamed at the ears, but Manon shrugged, wiping the dirt and blood from her face before limping back to the Omega. She wouldn't give Iskra the satisfaction of claiming she'd almost killed her, and Manon was in no shape to settle this in a proper fight. Attack or clumsiness, Asterin was punished by Mother Blackbeak that night for letting the heir fall into the pit. Manon had asked to be the one to dispense the whipping, but her grandmother ignored her. Instead, she had the Yellowleg's heir do it. As Asterin's failure had occurred in plain sight of the other matrons and their heirs, so would her punishment. Standing in the mess hall, Manon watched each brutal lash, all 10 of them at full strength, as Iskra sported a bruise on her jaw courtesy of Asterin. To her everlasting credit, Asterin didn't scream, not once. It still took all of Manon's self-restraint to keep from grabbing the whip and using it to strangle Iskra. Then came the conversation with her grandmother. It wasn't so much a conversation as it was a slap in the face, then a verbal beating that, a day later, still made Manon's ears ring. She'd humiliated her grandmother and every Blackbeak in history by picking that runty scrap of meat, regardless of his victory. It was a fluke that he'd killed Titus, her grandmother ranted. Abraxos was the smallest of any of the mounts, and on top of that, because of his size, he had never flown a day in his life. They had never let him out of the warrens. They didn't even know if he could fly after his wings had taken a beating for so long. And the handlers were of the opinion that should Abraxos attempt the crossing, he'd splatter himself and Manon on the gap floor. They claimed no other wyverns would ever accept his dominance, not as wing leader. Manon had ruined all of her grandmother's plans. All these facts were shouted at her again and again. She knew that even if she wanted to change mounts, her grandmother would force her to keep Abraxos, just to humiliate her when she failed. Even if it got her killed in the process. Her grandmother hadn't been in the pit, though. She hadn't looked into Abraxos' eyes and seen the warrior's heart beating in him. She hadn't noticed that he'd fought with more cunning and ferocity than any of the others. So Manon held firm and took the slap to the face, and the lecture, and then the second slap that left her cheek throbbing. Manon's face was still aching when she reached the pen in which Abraxos now made his home. He was curled by the far wall, silent and still, when so many of the creatures were pacing or shrieking or growling. Her escort, the overseer, peered through the bars. Astarin lurked in the shadows. After the whipping last night, her second wasn't going to let her out of her sight anytime soon. Manon hadn't apologized for the whipping. The rules were the rules, and her cousin had failed. Astarin deserved the lashing, just as Manon deserved the bruise on her cheek.
"Why's he curled up like that?"
Manon asked the man.
"Suspect it's 'cause he's never had a pen to himself. Not this big, anyway."
Manon studied the penned-in cavern.
"Where did they keep him before?"
The man pointed at the floor.
"With the other baiters in the sty. He's the oldest of the baiters, you know. Survived the pits and the styes. But that doesn't mean he's suitable for you."
"If I wanted your opinion on his suitability, I'd ask for it," Manon said, eyes still on Abraxos as she approached the bars.
"How long to get him in the skies?"
The man rubbed his head.
"Could be days or weeks or months. Could be never.
We begin training with our mounts this afternoon."
"Not going to happen."
Manon raised her brows.
"This one needs to be trained alone first. I'll get our best trainers on it, and you can use another wyvern in the meantime to—"
"First of all, human," Manon interrupted. "Don't give me orders." Her iron teeth snapped out, and he flinched.
"Second, I won't be training with another wyvern. I'll train with him."
The man was pale as death as he said,
"All your sentinels' mounts will attack him, and the first flight will spook him so bad that he'll fight back. So, unless you want your soldiers and their mounts to tear each other apart, I suggest you train alone."
He trembled and added,
"M'lady."
The wyvern was watching them, waiting.
"Can they understand us?"
"No. Some spoken commands and whistles, but no more than a dog."
Manon didn't believe that for one moment. It wasn't that he was lying to her. He just didn't know any better. Or maybe Abraxos was different. She'd use every moment until the war games to train him. When she and her 13 were crowned victors, she'd make each and every one of the witches who doubted her, her grandmother included, curse themselves for fools. Because she was Manon Blackbeak, and she'd never failed at anything. And there would be nothing better than watching Abraxos bite off Iskra's head on the battlefield. Chapter 24. It was far too easy to lie to his men about the bruises and cuts on his face when Kaol returned to the castle. An unfortunate incident with a drunk vagrant in Rifthold. Enduring the lies and the injuries was better than being carrion. Kaol's bargain with Adian and the rebels had been simple. Information for information. He'd promised more information about their queen, as well as about the king's black rings, in exchange for what they knew regarding the king's power. It had kept him alive that night, and every night afterward, when he'd waited for them to change their minds. But they never came for him. And tonight, he and Adian waited until well past 12 before slipping into Selena's old rooms. It was the first time he'd dared return to the tomb since that night with Selena and Dorian, and the skull-shaped bronze knocker, Mort, didn't move or speak at all. Even though Kaol wore the Eye of Elena at his throat, the knocker remained frozen. Perhaps Mort only answered to those with Bran and Galathinius's blood in their veins. So he and Adian combed through the tomb, the dusty halls, scouring every inch for signs of spies or ways to be discovered. When they were at last satisfied that no one could overhear them, Adian said,
"Tell me what I'm doing down here, Captain."
The general had shown no awe or surprise as Kaol had led him into Elena and Gavin's resting place, though his eyes had widened slightly at Damaris. But whether or not Adian knew what it was, he'd said nothing. For all his brashness and arrogance, Kaol had a feeling the man had many, many secrets, and was damn good at concealing them. It was the other reason why he'd offered the bargain to Adian and his companions. If the prince's gifts were discovered, Dorian would need somewhere to hide, and someone to get him to safety if Kaol were incapacitated. Kaol said,
"Are you prepared to share whatever information you've gathered from your allies?"
Adian gave him a lazy grin. "So long as you share yours." Kaol prayed to any god that would listen that he wasn't making the wrong move, as he pulled the eye of Elena from his tunic.
"Your queen gave this necklace to me when she left for Wendland. It belonged to her ancestor, who summoned her here to give it to her."
Adian's eyes narrowed as he took in the amulet, the blue stone shimmering in the moonlight.
"What I am about to tell you," Kaol said, "changes everything."
Dorian stood in the shadows of the stairwell, listening. Listening, and not quite wanting to accept that Kaol was in the tomb with Adian Ashriver. That had been the first shock. For the past week, he'd been creeping down here to hunt for answers after his explosion with Sorsha. Especially now that she had lied through her teeth and risked everything to keep his secret, and to help him find a way to control it. Tonight he'd been horrified to find the secret door left slightly ajar. He shouldn't have come, but he'd done it anyway, making up an easy list of lies to tell should he find an unfriendly face down here. Then he'd gotten close enough to hear the two male voices and almost fled. Almost, until he'd realized who was talking. It was impossible, because they hated each other. Yet there they were in Elena's tomb. Allies. It was enough. Too much. But then he'd heard it. Heard what Kaol said to the general. So quietly it was barely audible.
"Your queen gave this necklace to me when she left for Wendland."
It was a mistake. It had to be a mistake, because his chest had become too tight, too small. "You will always be my enemy." That's what Selena had screamed at Kaol the night Nehemia died. And she'd said that she'd lost people 10 years ago, but. Dorian couldn't move as Kaol launched into another story, another truth, about Dorian's own father, about the power the king wielded. Selena had discovered it. Selena was trying to find a way to destroy it. His father had made that thing they'd fought in the library catacombs, that monstrous thing that had seemed human. Word keys, word gates, word stone. They had lied to him, too. They had decided he wasn't to be trusted. Selena and Kaol, they'd decided against him. Kaol had known who and what Selena truly was. It was why he'd sent her to Wendland, why he'd gotten her out of the castle. Dorian was still frozen on the stairs when Adian slipped out of the tomb, sword out, and looking ready to attack whatever enemy he'd detected. Spotting him, Adian swore, low and viciously, his eyes bright in the glow of his torch. Selena's eyes. Aelin Ashriver. Ashriver. Galathinius's eyes. Adian was her cousin, and he was still loyal to her, lying through his teeth, through every action, about where his allegiance lay. Kaol rushed into the hall, a hand lifted beseechingly.
"Dorian."
For a moment, he could only stare at his friend. Then he managed to say,
"Why?"
Kaol loosed a breath,
because the fewer people who know, the safer. For her, for everyone, for you. They have information that might help you. You think I'd run to my father?
The words were barely more than a strangled whisper as the temperature plummeted. Kaol stepped forward, putting himself between Adian and Dorian, his palms exposed, placating.
I can't afford to guess, to hope, even with you. How long?
Ice coated his teeth, his tongue.
She told me about your father before she left. I figured out who she is soon afterward.
And you're working with him now? The captain's breath clouded in front of him.
If we can find a way to free magic, it could save you. They think they might have some answers about what happened and how to reverse it. But if Adian and his allies are caught, if she is caught, they will die. Your father will put them all down, starting with her. And right now, Dorian, we need them.
Dorian turned to Adian.
Are you going to kill my father?
Does he not deserve to die? Was the general's reply. Dorian could see the captain wincing, not at the general's words, but at the cold.
Did you tell him about me?
Dorian ground out. No, Adian answered for Kaol. Though if you don't learn to control yourself, there soon won't be a soul in the realm who doesn't know you have magic. Adian slid those heirloom eyes to the captain. So that's why you were so desperate to trade secrets. You wanted the information for his sake.
A nod from Kaol. Adian smirked at Dorian, and ice coated the stairwell.
Does your magic manifest in ice and snow, then, princeling?
The general asked. Come closer and find out, Dorian said with a faint smile. Perhaps he could throw Adian across the hall, just as he had with that creature.
Adian can be trusted, Dorian, Kaol said. He's as two-faced as they come. I don't believe for one heartbeat that he wouldn't sell us out if it meant furthering his own cause.
He won't, Kaol snapped, cutting off Adian's reply. Kaol's lips went blue from the cold. Dorian knew he was hurting him, knew it, and didn't quite care.
Because you want to be Adian's king someday?
Kaol's face drained of color, from the cold or from fear, and Adian barked a laugh. My queen will die heirless sooner than marry a man from Otterlan. Kaol tried to hide his flicker of pain, but Dorian knew his friend well enough to spot it. For a second, he wondered what Selena would think about Adian's claim. Selena, who had lied. Selena, who was Aelin, whom he had met 10 years ago, whom he had played with in her beautiful castle. And that day in Endovir, that first day, he had felt as if there were something familiar about her. Oh, gods. Selena was Aelin Galathinius. He had danced with her, kissed her, slept beside her, his mortal enemy. I'll come back for you, she'd said her final day here. Even then, he'd known there was something else behind it. She would come back, but perhaps not as Selena. Would it be to help him, or to kill him? Aelin Galathinius knew about his magic, and wanted to destroy his father, his kingdom, everything she had ever said or done. He'd once thought it had been a charade to win his favor as champion. But what if it had been because she was the heir of Terrasen? Was that why she was friends with Nehemia? What if, after a year in Endovir, Aelin Galathinius had spent a year in that labor camp? A queen of their continent had been a slave.
and would bear the scars of it forever.
Perhaps that entitled her, and Adian, and even Kaol, who loved her, to conspire to deceive and betray his father.
"Dorian, please,"
Kaol said.
"I'm doing this for you. I swear it."
"I don't care," Dorian said, staring them down as he walked out.
"I will carry your secrets to the grave, but I want no part of them."
He ripped his cold magic from the air and turned it inward, wrapping it around his heart. Adian took the secret subterranean exit out of the castle. He'd told Kaol it was to avoid any suspicion, to lose anyone else trailing them as they went back to their rooms. One look from the captain told him he knew precisely where Adian was headed. Adian contemplated what the captain had told him, and though any other man would be horrified, though Adian should be horrified, he wasn't surprised. He'd suspected the king was wielding some sort of deadly power from the moment he'd given him that ring all those years ago, and it seemed in line with information his spies had long been gathering. The Yellowlegs matron had been here for a reason. Adian was willing to bet good money that whatever monstrosities or weapons the king was creating, they would see them soon enough, perhaps with the witches in tow. Men didn't build more armies and forge more weapons without having plans to use them, and they certainly didn't hand out bits of mind-controlling jewelry unless they wanted absolute dominion. But he would face what was coming just as he had every other trial in his life. Precisely, unyieldingly, and with lethal efficiency. He spotted the two figures waiting in the shadows of a ramshackle building by the docks, the fog off the Avery making them little more than wisps of darkness.
"Well?"
Ren demanded, as Adian leaned against a damp brick wall. Ren's twin swords were out. Good Otterlanian steel, nicked and scratched enough to show they'd been used, and well-oiled enough to show Ren knew how to care for them. They seemed to be the only things Ren cared about. His hair was shaggy, and his clothes looked a bit worse for wear.
"I already told you. We can trust the captain."
Adian looked at Murtaug.
"Hello, old man."
He couldn't see Murtaug's face beneath the shadows of his hood, but his voice was too soft as he said,
"I hope the information is worth the risks you are taking."
Adian snarled. He wouldn't tell them the truth about Aelin, not until she was back at his side and could tell them herself. Ren took a step closer. He moved with the self-assurance of someone who was used to fighting and winning. Still, Adian had at least 3 inches and 20 pounds of muscle on him. Should Ren attack, he'd find himself on his ass in a heartbeat.
"I don't know what game you're playing, Adian,"
Ren said,
"but if you don't tell us where she is, how can we trust you? And how does the captain know? Does the king have her?"
"No,"
Adian said. It wasn't a lie, but it felt like one. As Selena, she'd signed her soul to him.
"The way I see it, Ren, you and your grandfather have little to offer me, or Aelin. You don't have a warband, you don't have lands, and the captain told me all about your affiliation with that piece of shit Archer Finn. Do I need to remind you what happened to Nehemia Yitgar on your watch? So I'm not going to tell you. You'll receive information on a need-to-know basis."
Ren started. Murtaug put an arm between them.
"It's better we don't know, just in case."
Ren wouldn't back down, and Adian's blood raced at the challenge.
"What are we going to tell the court, then?"
Ren demanded.
"That she's not some imposter as we were led to believe, but actually alive, yet you won't tell us where?"
"Yes,"
Adian breathed, wondering just how badly he could bloody up Ren without hurting Murtaug in the process.
"That's exactly what you'll tell them, if you can even find the court."
Silence. Murtagh said,
We know Ravi and Sol are still alive and in Surya.
Adian knew the story. Their family's trade business had been too important to the king to warrant executing both their parents. So their father had chosen the execution block, and their mother had been left to keep Surya running as a vital trade port. The two Surian boys would be 20 and 22 by now, and since his mother's death, Sol had become lord of Surya. In his years leading the Bane, Adian had never set foot in the coastal city. He didn't want to know if they'd damn him. Otterlin's whore.
Will they fight? Adian said.
Or will they decide they like their gold too much? Murtagh sighed.
I've heard Ravi is the wilder one. He might be the one to convince.
I don't want anyone that we have to convince to join us, Adian said.
You'll want people who aren't afraid of Aelin, or you,
Murtagh snapped.
You'll want level-headed people who won't hesitate to ask the hard questions. Loyalty is earned, not given.
She doesn't have to do a damn thing to earn our loyalty. Murtagh shook his head, his cowl swaying.
For some of us, yes, but others might not be so easily convinced. She has 10 years to account for, and a kingdom in ruin.
She was a child.
She is a woman now, and has been for a few years. Perhaps she will offer an explanation. But until then, Adian, you must understand that others might not share your fervor, and others might take a good amount of convincing about you as well, about where your true loyalties lie, and how you have demonstrated them over the years.
He wanted to bash Murtagh's teeth down his throat, if only because he was right. Who else of Orlan's inner circle is still alive? Murtagh named 4. Wren quickly added,
We heard they were in hiding for years, always moving around like us. They might not be easy to find. 4.
Adian's stomach dropped.
That's it?
He'd been in Terrasen, but he'd never looked for an exact body count. Never wanted to know who made it through the bloodshed and slaughter, or who had sacrificed everything to get a child, a friend, a family member out. Of course, he'd known deep down, but there had always been some fool's hope that most were still alive, still waiting to return.
I'm sorry, Adian, Murtagh said softly. Some minor lords escaped, and even managed to hold on to their lands and keep them thriving.
Adian knew and hated most of them, self-serving pigs. Murtagh went on.
Vernon Lochin survived, but only because he was already the king's puppet, and after Cal was executed, Vernon seized his brother's mantle as Lord of Peranth. You know what happened to Lady Marion. But we never learned what happened to Elide.
Elide? Lord Cal and Lady Marion's daughter and heir, almost a year younger than Aelin. If she were alive, she would be at least 17 by now.
Lots of children vanished in the initial weeks,
Murtagh finished. Adian didn't want to think about those two small graves. He had to look away for a moment. And even Wren stayed quiet. At last, Adian said,
Send out feelers to Ravi and Sol,
but hold off on the others. Ignore the minor lords for now. Small steps. To his surprise, Wren said,
Agreed.
For a heartbeat, their eyes met, and he knew that Wren felt what he often did, what he tried to keep buried. They had survived, when so many had not. And no one else could understand what it was like to bear it, unless they had lost as much. Wren had escaped at the cost of his parents' lives, and had lost his home, his title, his friends, and his kingdom. He had hidden and trained and never lost sight of his cause. They were not friends now. They never really had been. Ren's father hadn't particularly liked that Adian, not Ren, was favored to take the blood oath to Aelin. The oath of pure submission. The oath that would have sealed Adian as her lifelong protector. The one person in whom she could have absolute trust. Everything he possessed, everything he was, should have belonged to her. Yet the prize now was not just a blood oath, but a kingdom. A shot at vengeance and rebuilding their world. Adian made to walk away, but looked back. Just two cloaked figures. One hunched, the other tall and armed. The first shred of Aelin's court. The court he'd raise for her to shatter Otterlin's chains. He could keep playing the game for a little longer. When she returns, Adian said quietly, what she will do to the King of Otterlin will make the slaughtering 10 years ago look merciful. And in his heart, Adian hoped he spoke true. Chapter 25. A week passed without any further attempts to skin Selena alive, so even though she made absolutely no progress with Rowan, she considered it to be a success. Rowan lived up to his word about her pulling double duty in the kitchens, the only upside of which was that she was so exhausted when she tumbled into bed that she did not remember dreaming. Another benefit, she supposed, was that while she was scrubbing the evening dishes, she could listen to Emrys' stories, which Luca begged for every night, regardless of rain. Despite what had happened with the skinwalkers, Selena was no closer to mastering her shift. Even though Rowan had offered his cloak that night beside the river, the next morning had brought them back to their usual vitriolic dislike. Hatred felt like a strong word, as she couldn't quite hate someone who saved her, but dislike fit pretty damn well. She didn't particularly care what side of the hatred-dislike line Rowan was on. But gaining his approval to enter Doranel was undoubtedly a long, long way off. Every day he brought her to the temple ruins, far enough away that if she did manage to shift and lost control of her magic in the process, she wouldn't incinerate anyone. Everything, everything depended on that command. Shift. But the memory of what the magic had felt like as it seared out of her, when it threatened to swallow her and the whole world, plagued her, waking and asleep. It was almost as bad as the endless sitting. Now, after 2 miserable hours of it, she groaned and stood, stalking around the ruins. It was unusually sunny that day, making the pale stones seem to glow. In fact, she could have sworn that the whispered prayers of long-gone worshippers still resonated. Her magic had been flickering oddly in response. Strange, in her human form, where it was normally so bolted down. As she studied the ruins, she braced her hands on her hips, anything to keep from ripping out her hair.
What was this place anyway?
Only slabs of broken stone remained to show where the temple had stood. A few oblong stones, pillars, were tossed about as if a hand had scattered them, and several stones grouped together indicated what had once been a road. Rowan dogged her steps, a thundercloud closing in around her as she examined a cluster of white stones.
The Sun Goddess's Temple.
Mala. Lady of Light, Learning, and Fire.
You've been bringing me here because you think it might help with mastering my powers? My shifting?
A vague nod. She put a hand on one of the massive stones. If she felt like admitting it, she could almost sense the echoes of the power that had dwelled here long ago. A delicious heat kissing its way up her neck, down her spine. As if some piece of that goddess were still curled up in the corner. It explained why today, in the sun, The temple felt different.
Why, her magic was jumpy.
Mala, sun goddess and lightbringer, was sister and eternal rival to Diana, keeper of the moon.
Mab was immortalized into godhood thanks to Maeve.
Selena mused, as she ran a hand down the jagged block.
But that was over 500 years ago. Mala had a sister in the moon long before Mab took her place.
Diana was the original sister's name, but you humans gave her some of Mab's traits. The hunting, the hounds.
Perhaps Diana and Mala weren't always rivals.
What are you getting at?
She shrugged and kept running her hands along the stone, feeling, breathing, smelling.
Did you ever know Mab?
Rowan was quiet for a long moment, contemplating the usefulness of telling her, no doubt.
No,
he said at last.
I am old, but not that old.
Fine, if he didn't want to give her an actual number. Do you feel old? He gazed into the distance.
I am still considered young by the standards of my kind.
It wasn't an answer.
You said that you once campaigned in a kingdom that no longer exists. You've been off to war several times, it seems, and seen the world.
That would leave its mark. Age you on the inside.
Do you feel old?
His gaze was unflinching. A child.
A girl, he'd called her.
She was a girl to him. Even when she became an old woman, if she lived that long, she'd still be a child in comparison to his lifespan. Her mission depended upon his seeing her otherwise. But she still said,
These days I'm very glad to be a mortal, and to only have to endure this life once. These days I don't envy you at all.
And before?
It was her turn to stare toward the horizon.
I used to wish I had a chance to see it all, and hated that I never would.
She could feel him forming a question, but she started moving again, examining the stones. As she dusted the block off, an image emerged of a stag with a glowing star between its antlers, so like the one in Terrasen. She'd heard Emrys tell the story of the sun stags, who held an immortal flame between their massive antlers, and who had once been stolen from a temple in this land.
Is this where the stags were kept, before this place was destroyed?
I don't know. This temple wasn't destroyed. It was abandoned when the Fae moved to Doranel, and then ruined by time and weather.
Emrys' story said destroyed, not abandoned.
Again, what are you getting at?
But she didn't know. Not yet.
So she just shook her head and said,
The Fae on my continent, in Terrasen, they weren't like you. At least, I don't remember them being that way. There weren't many, but...
She swallowed hard.
The King of Otterlin hunted and killed them so easily. Yet when I look at you, I don't understand how he did it.
Even with the word keys, the Fae had been stronger, faster. More should have survived, even if some had been trapped in their animal forms when magic vanished. She looked over her shoulder at him, one hand still pressed against the warm carving. A muscle flickered in Rowan's jaw before he said,
I've never been to your continent, but I heard that the Fae there were gentler, less aggressive, very few trained in combat, and they relied heavily on magic. Once magic was gone from your lands, many of them might not have known what to do against trained soldiers.
And yet Maeve wouldn't send aid.
The Fae of your continent long ago severed ties with Maeve.
He paused again.
But there were some in Doranel who argued in favor of helping.
my queen wound up offering sanctuary to any who could make it here.
She didn't want to know more. Didn't want to know how many had made it, and whether he had been one of the few who argued to save their Western brethren. So she moved away from the carving of the mythical stag, instantly cold as she severed contact with the delightful heat living within the stone. Part of her could have sworn that ancient, strange power was sad to see her go. The next day, Selena finished her breakfast shift in the kitchens, achy and more drained than usual, as Luca hadn't been there to help, which meant she'd spent the morning chopping, washing, and then running the food upstairs. Selena passed a sentry she'd marked as Luca's friend and a frequent listener to Emrys' stories. Young, leanly muscled, with no evidence of fey ears or grace. Bass, the leader of the fortress scouts. Luca prattled about him endlessly. Selena gave him a small smile and nod. Bass blinked a few times, gave a tentative smile back, and sauntered on, probably to his watch on the wall. She frowned. She'd said a civilized hello to plenty of them by now, but she was still puzzling over his reaction when she reached her room and shrugged on her jacket.
"You're already late," Rowan said from the doorway.
"There were extra dishes this morning," she said, rebraiding her hair as she turned to where he lounged in the doorway. "Can I expect to do something useful with you today? Or will it be more sitting and growling and glaring? Or will I just wind up chopping wood for hours on end?" He merely started into the hall and she followed, still braiding her hair. They passed another two sentries. This time she looked them both in the eye and smiled her greeting. Again, that blink, and a shared look between them, and a returned grin. Had she really become so unpleasant that a mere smile was surprising? Gods, when had she smiled last? At anyone or anything? They were well away from the fortress, headed south and up into the mountains, when Rowan said,
"They've all been keeping their distance because of the scent you put out."
"Excuse me?"
She didn't want to know how he'd read her thoughts. Rowan stalked through the trees, not even out of breath, as he said, "There are more males than females here, and they're fairly isolated from the world. Haven't you wondered why they haven't approached you?"
"They stayed away because I smell?" She didn't think she would have cared enough to be embarrassed, but her face was burning.
"Your scent says that you don't want to be approached. The males smell it more than the females, and have been staying the hell away. They don't want to get their faces clawed off."
She had forgotten how primal the Fae were, with their scents and mating and territorial nature. Such a strange contrast to the civilized world beyond the wall of the mountains. "Good," she wound up saying, though the idea of her having emotions so easily identifiable was unsettling. It made lying and pretending almost worthless. "I'm not interested in men. Males." His tattoo was vivid in the dappled sunlight that streamed through the canopy as he stared pointedly at her ring.
"What happens if you become queen? Will you refuse a potential alliance through marriage?"
An invisible hand seemed to wrap around her throat. She had not let herself consider that possibility, because the weight of a crown and a throne were enough to make her feel like she was in a coffin. The thought of marrying like that, of someone else's body on hers, someone who was not Kaol. She shoved the thought away. Rowan was baiting her, as he always did, and she still had no plans to take up her uncle's throne. Her only plan was to do what she'd promised Nehemia. "Nice try," she said. His canines gleamed as he smirked.
"You're learning."
"You get baited by me every now and then, too, you know." He gave her a look that said,
"I let you bait me, in case you haven't noticed.
I'm not some mortal fool.
She wanted to ask why, but being cordial with him, with anyone, was already odd enough. Where the hell are we going today? We never head west. The smirk vanished.
You want to do something useful, so here's your chance.
With Selena in her human form, the bells of some nearby town were heralding 3 o'clock by the time they reached the Pinewood. She didn't ask what they were doing here. He'd tell her if he wanted to. Slowing to a prowl, Rowan tracked markers left on trees and stones, and she quietly trailed him, thirsty and hungry and a bit lightheaded. The terrain had shifted. Pine needles crunched beneath her boots, and gulls, not songbirds, cried overhead. The sea had to be close. Selena groaned as a cool breeze kissed her sweaty face, scented with salt and fish and sun-warmed rock. It wasn't until Rowan halted by a stream that she noticed the reek and the silence. The ground had been churned up across the stream, the brush broken and trampled. But Rowan's attention was fixed on the stream itself, on what had been wedged between the rocks. Selena swore. A body. A woman by the shape of what was left of her, and a husk. As if she had been drained of life, of substance. No wounds, no lacerations or signs of harm, save for a trickle of dried blood from her nose and ears. Her skin was leached of color, withered and dried, her hollowed-out face still stuck in an expression of horror and sorrow. And the smell. Not just the rotting body, but around it. The smell.
What did this?
She asked, studying the disturbed forest beyond the stream. Rowan knelt as he examined the remains. Why not just dump her in the sea? Leaving her in a stream seems idiotic. They left tracks, too. Unless those are from whoever found her.
Malachi gave me the report this morning, and he and his men are trained not to leave tracks. But this scent, I'll admit it's different.
Rowan walked into the water. She wanted to tell him to stop, but he kept studying the remains from above, then below, circling. His eyes flashed to hers. They were furious.
So you tell me, assassin. You wanted to be useful.
She bristled at the tone, but that was a woman lying there, broken like a doll. Selena didn't particularly want to smell anything on the remains, but she sniffed and wished she hadn't. It was a smell she'd scented twice now, once in that bloody chamber a decade ago, and then recently.
You claimed you didn't know what that thing in the barrow field was,
she managed to say. The woman's mouth was open in a scream, her teeth brown and cracked below the dried nosebleed. Selena touched her own nose and winced.
I think this is what it does.
Rowan braced his hands on his hips, sniffing again, turning in the stream. He scanned Selena, then the body.
You came out of that darkness looking as if someone had sucked the life from you. Your skin was a shade paler, your freckles gone.
It forced me to go through memories.
The worst kind.
The woman's horrified, sorrowful face gaped up at the canopy. Have you ever heard of a creature that can feed on such things? When I glimpsed it, I saw a man, a beautiful man, pale and dark-haired, with eyes of full black. He wasn't human. I mean, he looked it, but his eyes, they weren't human at all. Her parents had been assassinated. She'd seen the wounds, but the smell in their room had been so similar. She shook her head as if to clear it, to shake the creeping feeling moving up her spine.
Even my queen doesn't know every foul creature roaming these lands. If the skinwalkers are venturing down from the mountains, perhaps other things are too.
The townspeople might know something. Maybe they've seen it or heard rumors. Rowan seemed to be thinking the same thing, because he shook his head in disgust. And sorrow, to her surprise.
We don't have the time. You wasted daylight by coming here in your human form.
They hadn't brought any overnight supplies, either.
We have an hour before we head back. Make the most of it.
The path led absolutely nowhere. It ran into a sea cliff with no way to the narrow strip of beach below. No sign of anyone living nearby. Rowan stood at the cliff's edge, arms crossed as he stared out at the jade sea.
It doesn't make sense, he said,
more to himself than to her.
This is the fourth body in the last few weeks. None of them reported missing.
He squatted on the sandy ground and drew a rough line in the dirt with a tattooed finger, the shape of Wendland's coastline.
They've been found here.
Little dots, seemingly random save for being close to the water.
We're here,
he said, making another dot. He sat back on his heels as Selene appeared at the crude map.
And yet you and I encountered the creature lurking amongst the Barrow Whites here,
he added, and drew an X where she assumed the mounds were, deep inland.
I haven't seen any further signs of it remaining by the Barrows, and the Whites have returned to their usual habits.
Were the other bodies the same?
All were drained like this, with expressions of terror on their faces. Not a hint of a wound, beyond dried blood at the nose and ears.
From the way his tan skin paled beneath his tattoo, the way he gritted his teeth, she knew that it rankled his immortal pride not to know what this thing was. All dumped in the forest, not the sea? A nod. But all within walking distance of the water. Another nod. If it were a skilled sentient killer, it would hide the bodies better. Or again, use the sea. She gazed to the blinding water, the sun starting its afternoon descent. Or maybe it doesn't care. Maybe it wants us to know what it's doing. There were times when I left bodies so that they'd be found by a certain person, or to send a type of message. Grave being the latest of them. What do the victims have in common?
I don't know,
he admitted.
We don't even know their names or where they came from.
He rose and dusted his hands off.
We need to return to the fortress.
She grabbed his elbow. Wait. Have you seen enough of the body? A slow nod. Good. So had she, and she'd had enough of the smell, too. She'd committed it to memory, noting everything that she could. Then we've got to bury her.
The ground's too hard here.
She stalked through the trees, leaving him behind. Then we'll do it the ancient way, she called. She'd be damned if she left that woman's body decomposing in a stream. Damned if she left her there for all eternity. Wet and cold. Selene pulled the too light body out of the stream, laying it on the brown pine needles. Rowan didn't say anything as she gathered kindling and branches, and then knelt, trying not to look at the shriveled skin or the expression of lingering horror. Neither did he mock her for the few times it took to get the fire started by hand, or make any snide comments once the pine needles finally crinkled and smoked. Ancient incense for a rudimentary pyre. Instead, as she stepped from the rising flames, she felt him come to tower behind her, felt the surety and half-wildness of him wrap around her like a phantom body. A warm breeze licked at her hair, her face. Air to help the fire, wind that helped consume the corpse. The loathing she felt had nothing to do with her vow or Nehemia. Selena reached into the ageless pit inside her. Just once, to see if she could pull up whatever trigger it was that caused the shift, so she could help her sad little fire burn more evenly, more proudly. Yet Selena remained stale and empty, stranded in her mortal body. Still, Rowan didn't say anything about it, and his wind fed the flames enough to make quick work of the body, burning far faster than a mortal pyre. They watched in silence, until there was nothing but ashes, until even those were carried up and away, over the trees, and toward the open sea. Chapter 26. Kaol hadn't seen or heard from the general or the prince since that night in the tomb. According to his men, the prince was spending his time in the healer's catacombs, courting one of the young women down there. He hated himself, but some part of him was relieved to hear it. At least Dorian was talking to someone. The rift with Dorian was worth it. For Dorian, even if his friend never forgave him. For Selena, even if she never came back. Even if he wished she were still Selena and not Aelin. It was worth it. It was a week before he had time to meet with Adian again, to get the information that he hadn't received thanks to Dorian interrupting them. If Dorian had snuck up on them so easily, then the tomb wasn't the best place to meet. There was one place, however, where they could gather with minimal risk. Selena had left it to him in her will, along with the address. The secret apartment above the warehouse was untouched, though someone had taken the time to cover the ornate furniture. Pulling the sheets off one by one was like uncovering a bit more of who Selena had been before in Dovier, proof that her lavish tastes ran deep. She'd bought this place, she'd once told him, to have somewhere to call her own, a place outside the Assassin's Keep where she'd been raised. She'd dropped almost every copper she had into it, but it had been necessary, she said, for the bit of freedom it had granted her. He could have left the sheets on, probably should have, but he was curious. The apartment consisted of two bedrooms with their own bathing rooms, a kitchen, and a great room in which a deep cushioned couch sprawled before a carved marble fireplace, accented by two oversized velvet armchairs. The other half of the room was occupied by an oak dining table capable of seating eight, its place settings still laid out. Plates of porcelain and silver, flatware that had long since gone dull. It was the only evidence that this apartment had been untouched since whoever, Aerobin Hommel, probably, had ordered the place sealed up. Aerobin Hommel, the king of the assassins. Kaol gritted his teeth as he finished stuffing the last of the white sheets into the hallway closet. He'd been thinking a good deal about Selena's old master in the past few days. Aerobin was smart enough to have put things together when he found a washed-up orphan right after the Princess of Terrasen went missing. Her body vanished into the half-frozen Florine River. If Aerobin had known, and done those things to her. The scar on Selena's wrist flashed before him. He'd made her break her own hand. There must have been countless other brutalities that Selena didn't even tell him about. And the worst of them. The absolute worst. He'd never asked Selena why. When she was appointed champion, her first priority wasn't hunting down her master and cutting him into pieces for what he'd done to her lover, Sam Cortland. Aerobin had ordered Sam tortured and killed, and then devised a trap for Selena that got her hauled off to Endovier. Arobin must have expected to retrieve her someday, if he'd left this apartment untouched. He must have wanted to let her rot in Endovir, until he decided to free her and she crawled back to him, his eternally loyal servant. It was her right, Kaol told himself. Her right to decide when and how to kill Arobin. It was Adian's right, too. Even the two lords of Terrasen had more of a claim on Arobin's head than he did. But if Kaol ever saw him, he wasn't sure he would be able to restrain himself. The rickety wooden staircase beyond the front door groaned, and Kaol had his sword drawn in a heartbeat. Then there was a low, two-note whistle, and he relaxed just slightly, and whistled back. He kept his sword drawn until Adian strode through the door, sword out.
I was wondering whether you'd be here alone, or with a gaggle of men waiting in the shadows.
Adian said by way of greeting, sheathing his sword. Kaol glared at him.
Likewise.
Adian moved farther into the apartment, the fierceness on his face shifting among wariness, wonder, and sorrow. And it occurred to Kaol that this apartment was the first time Adian was seeing a piece of his lost cousin. These were her things. She had selected everything, from the figurines atop the mantel, to the green napkins, to the old farm table in the kitchen, flecked and marred by what seemed like countless knives. Adian paused in the center of the room, scanning everything. Perhaps to see if there were indeed any hidden forces lying in wait. But Kaol muttered something about using the bathing room and gave Adian the privacy he needed. This was her apartment. Whether she accepted or hated her past, she decorated the dining table in Terrasen's royal colors, green and silver. The table and the stag figurine atop the mantel were the only shreds of proof that she might remember, might care. Everything else was comfortable, tasteful, as if the apartment were for lounging and nights by the fire. And there were so many books, on shelves, on the tables by the couch, stacked beside the large armchair before the curtained floor-to-ceiling window spanning the entire length of the great room. Smart, educated, cultured if the knick-knacks were any indication. There were things from across the kingdoms, as if she'd picked up something everywhere she went. The room was a map of her adventures, a map of a whole different person. Aelin had lived. She'd lived and seen and done things. The kitchen was small but cozy, and, gods, she had a cooling box. The captain had mentioned her being notorious as an assassin, but he hadn't mentioned that she was rich. All that blood money, all these things just proof of what she'd lost, what he'd failed to protect. She'd become a killer. A damned good one, if this apartment was any indication. Her bedroom was even more outrageous. It had a massive four-poster bed with a mattress that looked like a cloud, and an attached marble-tiled bathing room that possessed its own plumbing system. Well, her closet hadn't changed. His cousin had always loved pretty clothes. Adian pulled out a deep blue tunic, gold embroidery around the lapels and buttons glimmering in the light from the sconces. These were clothes for a woman's body, and the scent still clinging to the entire apartment belonged to a woman, so similar to what he remembered from childhood, but wrapped in mystery and secret smiles. It was impossible for his fey senses not to notice, to react. Adian leaned against the wall of the dressing room, staring at the gowns and the displays of jewelry, now coated in dust. He didn't let himself care about what had been done to him in the past, the people he'd ruined, the battlefields he'd walked off covered in blood and gore that wasn't his own. as far as he was concerned. He'd lost everything the day Aelin died. He had deserved the punishment for how badly he'd failed. But Aelin... Adian ran his hands through his hair before stepping into the great room. Aelin would come back from Wendlin, no matter what the captain believed. Aelin would come back, and when she did... With every breath, Adian felt that lingering scent wrapping tighter around his heart and soul. When she came back, he was never letting her go. Adian sank onto one of the armchairs before the fire, as Kaol said,
Well, I think I've waited long enough to hear what you have to say about magic. I hope it's worthwhile.
Regardless of what I know, magic shouldn't be your main plan of defense or action.
I saw your queen cleave the earth in two with her power, Kaol said. Tell me that wouldn't turn the tide on a battlefield. Tell me that you wouldn't need that, and others like her.
She won't be anywhere near those battlefields. Adian snarled softly. Kaol highly doubted that that was true, but wished it was. Adian would probably have to bind Selena to her throne to keep her from fighting on the front lines with her people.
Just tell me.
Adian sighed and gazed at the fire, as if beholding a distant horizon. The burnings and executions had already started by the time magic disappeared. So the day it happened, I thought the birds were just fleeing the soldiers or looking for carrion. I was locked in one of the tower rooms by the king's orders. Most days I didn't dare look out the window, because I didn't want to see what was happening in the city below. But there was such noise from the birds that day that I looked. And... Adian shook his head. Something sent them all flying up in one direction. Then another. And then the screaming started. I heard some people just died right on the spot, as if an artery had been cut.
Adian spread out a map on the low table between them and put a calloused finger on Orinth.
There were two waves of birds. The first went north-northwest.
He traced a vague line.
From the tower, I could see far enough that I knew many of them had come from the south. Most of the birds near us didn't move much. But then the second wave shoved all of them to the north and east, like something from the center of the land threw them that way.
Kaol pointed to Perenth, the second largest city in Terrasen.
From here?
Farther south. Adian knocked Kaol's hand out of the way.
And Dovier are even lower. You couldn't have seen that far.
No, but the warrior lords of my court made me memorize the birds in Oakwald, and all their calls for hunting, and fighting. And there were birds flying up toward us that were only found in your country. I was counting them to distract myself while... Another pause, as if Adian hadn't meant to say that.
I don't remember hearing any birds from the three southern kingdoms.
Kaol made a rough line, starting in Rifthold and going out toward the mountains, toward the Farian Gap.
Like something shot out in this direction.
It wasn't until the second wave that magic stopped. Adian raised a brow.
Don't you remember that day? I was here. If anyone felt pain, they hid it. Magic's been illegal in Otterland for decades. So where does all this get us, Adian?
Well, Murtaug and Wren had similar experiences. So then the general launched into another tale. Like Adian, Wren and Murtaug had experienced a frenzy of local animals, and twin waves of something the day magic had disappeared. But they'd been in the southern part of their continent, having just arrived in Skull's Bay. It wasn't until 6 months ago, when they'd been lured into the city by Archer Finn's lies about Aelin's reemergence, that they'd started considering magic, contemplating ways to break the king's power for their queen. After comparing notes with the other rebels in Rifthold,
they realized that others had experienced similar phenomena. Wanting to get a full account, they'd found a merchant from the deserted peninsula who was willing to talk. A man from Xandria who was surprisingly honest, despite the business he'd built on contraband items.
I stole an Asterian mare from the Lord of Xandria. Of course Selena had been to the deserted peninsula and sought out trouble. Despite the ache in his chest, Kaol smiled at the memory as Adian recalled Murtaugh's report of the merchant's account. Not two waves when magic vanished in the desert, but three. The first swept down from the north. The merchant had been with the Lord of Xandria in his fortress high above the city and had seen a faint tremor that made the red sand dance. The second came from the southwest, barreling right toward them like a sandstorm. The final pulse came from the same inland source Adian remembered. Seconds later, magic was gone, and people were screaming in the streets, and the Lord of Xandria got the order, a week later, to put down all the known or registered magic wielders in his city. Then the screaming had become different. Adian gave him a sly grin as he finished. But Murtaugh figured out more. We're meeting in 3 days. He can tell you his theories then. Kaol started from his chair.
That's it? That's all you know? What you've been lording over me these past few weeks?
There's still more for you to tell me, so why should I tell you everything?
I've told you vital, world-changing information, Kaol said through his teeth. You've just told me stories.
Adian's eyes took on a lethal glint. You'll want to hear what Ren and Murtaugh have to say. Kaol didn't feel like waiting so long to hear it, but there were two state lunches and one formal dinner before then, and he was expected to attend all of them and present the king with his defense plans for all the events as well. After a moment, Adian said,
How do you stand working for him? How do you pretend you don't know what that bastard is doing? What he's done to innocent people? To the woman you claim to love? I'm doing what I have to do.
He didn't think Adian would understand anyway. Tell me why the captain of the guard, a lord of Otterlin, is helping his enemy. That's all the information I want from you today. Kaol wanted to say that, given how much he'd already told him, he didn't have to offer a damn thing. Instead, he said,
I grew up being told we were bringing peace and civilization to the continent. What I've seen recently has made me realize how much of it is a lie.
You knew about the labor camps, though. About the massacres.
It is easy to be lied to when you do not know any of those people firsthand.
But Selena with her scars, and Nehemia with her people butchered.
It's easy to believe when your king tells you that the people in Endovir deserve to be there, because they're criminals or rebels who tried to slaughter innocent Otterlanian families.
And how many of your countrymen would stand against your king if they too learned the truth? If they stopped to consider what it would be like if it were their family, their village being enslaved or murdered? How many would stand if they knew what power their prince possessed? If their prince rose up to fight with us?
Kaol didn't know.
And he wasn't sure he wanted to. As for Dorian, he could not ask that of his friend. Could not expect it. His goal was keeping Dorian safe. Even if it would cost him their friendship, he didn't want Dorian involved. Ever.
The past week had been terrifying and wonderful for Dorian. Terrifying because two more people knew his secret, and because he walked such a fine line when it came to controlling his magic, which seemed more volatile with each passing day. Wonderful because every afternoon, he visited the forgotten workroom Sorsha had discovered, tucked in a lower level of the catacombs where no one would find them. She brought books from the gods knew where, herbs and plants, and salts and powders, and every day they researched and trained and pondered. There weren't many books about dampening a power like his. Many had been burned, she'd told him. But she looked at the magic like a disease. If she could find the right channels to block, she could keep it contained. And if not, she always said, they could resort to drugging him, just enough to even out his moods. She didn't like the idea of it, and neither did he, though it was a comfort to know the option was there. An hour each day was all they could manage together. For that hour, regardless of the laws they were breaking, Dorian felt like himself again. Not twisted and reeling and stumbling through the dark, but grounded, calm. No matter what he told Sorsha, she never judged or betrayed him. Kaol had been that person once. Yet now, when it came to his magic, he could still see fear and a hint of disgust in Kaol's eyes. Did you know, Sorsha said from her spot across the work table, that before magic vanished, they had to find special ways of subduing gifted prisoners? Dorian looked up from his book, a useless tome on garden remedies. Before magic vanished, at the hand of his father and his word keys, his stomach turned. Because they'd use their magic to break out of prison? Sorsha studied the book again. That's why a lot of the old prisons use solid iron. It's immune to magic.
I know,
he said, and she raised a brow. She was slowly starting to come alive around him, though he'd also learned to read her subtle expressions better.
Back when my power first appeared, I tried using it on an iron door, and it didn't go well.
Sorsha chewed on her lip. It was surprisingly distracting. But iron's in your blood. So how does that work?
I think it was the gods' way of keeping us from growing too powerful. If we keep contact with the magic, if it's flowing through us for too long, we faint. Or worse.
I wonder what would happen if we increased the iron in your diet. Perhaps adding a large amount of treacle to your food. We give it to anemic patients, but if we gave you a highly concentrated dose, it would taste awful and could be dangerous, but...
But perhaps if it's in my body, then when the magic rises up...
He grimaced.
He might have balked at the memory of the agony when he'd tried to seal that iron door, but...
He couldn't bring himself to say no to her.
Do you have any here? Just something to add to a drink?
She didn't, but she got some. And within a quarter of an hour, Dorian said a prayer to Silba and swallowed it, cringing at the obscene sweetness. Nothing. Sorsha's eyes darted from his own to the pocket watch in her hand, counting, waiting to see if there was an adverse reaction. A minute passed, and then 10. Dorian had to go soon, and so did she. But after a while, Sorsha quietly said,
Try it. Try summoning it. The iron should be in your blood now.
He shut his eyes, and she added,
It reacts when you're upset, angry or scared or sad. Think about something that makes you feel that way.
She was risking her position, her life, everything for this. For him, the son of the man who had ordered his army to destroy her village, then slaughter her family with the other unwanted immigrants squatting in Rifthold. He didn't deserve it. He breathed in. Out.
She also didn't deserve the world of trouble he was bringing down upon her, or would continue to bring to her door every time he came here.
He knew when women liked him, and he'd known from the first moment he'd seen her that she found him attractive. He'd hoped that opinion hadn't changed for the worse, but now...
Think of what upsets you.
Everything upset him. It upset him that she was risking her life, that he had no choice but to endanger her. Even if he took that final step toward her, even if he took her into his bed like he so badly wanted to, he was still the Crown Prince. "You will always be my enemy," Selena had once said. There was no escaping his crown, or his father, who would behead Sorsha, burn her, and scatter her ashes to the wind if he found out she'd helped him. His father, whom his friends were now working to destroy. They had lied to him and ignored him for that cause, because he was a danger. To them, to Sorsha, and... Roaring pain surged from his core and up his throat, and he gagged. There was another wave, and a cool breeze tried to kiss his face, but it vanished like mist under the sun as the pain trembled through him. He leaned forward, squeezing his eyes shut as the agony and then the nausea went through him again, and again. But then it was quiet. Dorian opened his eyes to find Sorsha. Clever, steady, wonderful Sorsha, standing there, biting her lip. She took one step, toward him, not away for once. "Did it?" Dorian was on his feet so fast the chair rocked behind him, and had her face between his hands a heartbeat after that. "Yes," he breathed, and kissed her. It was fast, but her face was flushed, and her eyes wide as he pulled back. His own eyes were wide, gods be damned, and he was still rubbing his thumb against her soft cheek, still contemplating going back for more, because that hadn't been nearly enough. But she pulled away, returning to her work. As if it hadn't been anything other than an embarrassment. "Tomorrow," she murmured. She wouldn't look at him. He could hardly muster the words to tell her yes as he staggered out. She'd looked so surprised, and if he didn't get out, he was likely to kiss her again. But maybe she didn't want to be kissed. Chapter 27. Standing atop a viewing platform on the side of the Omega, Manon watched the first Yellowlegs coven of the day take the crossing. The plunge down, followed by the violent sweep up, was stunning, even when it was the Yellowlegs riders astride the wind. Leading them along the sheer face of the northern fang was Iskra. Her bull, a massive beast named Fendir, was a force of nature in himself. Though smaller than Titus, he was twice as nasty. "They suit each other," Asterin said from beside Manon. The rest of the 13 were in the sparring room, instructing the other covens in hand-to-hand combat. Faelene and Fallon, the green-eyed demon twins, were undoubtedly taking some pleasure from torturing the newest sentinels. They thrived on that sort of thing. Iskra and Fendir swept over the uppermost peak of the northern fang and vanished into the clouds, the other 12 riders trailing in tight formation. The cold wind whipped at Manon's face, beckoning to her. She was on her way to the caverns to see Abraxos, but she'd wanted to monitor the Yellowlegs crossing first, just to make sure they were truly gone for the next 3 hours. She looked across the span of the bridge to the Fang and its giant entryway. Screeching and roaring echoed from it, reverberating across the mountains. "I want you to keep the 13 occupied for the rest of the day," Manon said. As second, Asterin was the only one of the 13 with any sort of right to question her, and even then, it was only in very limited circumstances. "You're going to train with him?" Manon nodded. "Your grandmother said she'd gut me if I let you out of my sight again." Golden hair twining about her in the wind, Asterin's face, with its now crooked nose, was wary. "You're going to have to decide," Manon said, not bothering to bare her iron teeth.
Are you her spy, or my second? No hint of pain or fear or betrayal, just a slight narrowing of her eyes. I serve you.
She's your matron.
I serve you. For a heartbeat, Manon wondered when she'd ever earned that kind of loyalty. They weren't friends, at least not in the way that humans seemed to be friends. Every Blackbeak already owed her their loyalty and obedience as the heir. But this... Manon had never explained herself, her plans, or her intentions to anyone except her grandmother. But she found herself saying to her second, I'm still going to be wingleader. Asterin smiled, her iron teeth like quicksilver in the morning sun. We know. Manon lifted her chin. I want the 13 adding tumbling to their hand-to-hand training. And when you can handle your wyvern on your own, I want you in the skies when the yellow legs are aloft. I want to know where they fly, how they fly, and what they do.
Asterin nodded. I already have the shadows watching the yellow legs in the halls, she said, a glimmer of rage and bloodthirst in those gold-flecked black eyes.
When Manon raised a brow, Asterin said,
You didn't think I'd let Iskra off so easily, did you?
Manon could still feel the iron-tipped fingers digging into her back, shoving her into the pit. Her ankle was sore and stiff from the fall, her ribs bruised from the beating she'd taken from Titus's tail. Keep them in line, unless you want your nose broken a second time. Asterin flashed a grin.
We don't move without your command, lady.
Manon didn't want the overseer in the pen, or his three handlers all bearing spears and whips. She didn't want any of them for three reasons. The first was that she wanted to be alone with Abraxos, who was crouched against the back wall, waiting and watching. The second was that the human smell of them, the beckoning warmth of the blood pulsing in their necks, was distracting. The stench of their fear was distracting. She debated for a good minute whether it would be worth it to gut one of them just to see what the others would do. Already men were going missing from the Fang. Men who were rumored to have crossed the bridge to the Omega and never returned. Manon hadn't killed any of the men here yet, but every minute alone with them tempted her to play. And the third reason she resented their presence was that Abraxos loathed them, with their whips and spears and chains and their hulking presence. The wyvern wouldn't move from his spot against the wall, no matter how viciously they cracked their whips. He hated whips. Not just feared, but actually hated. The sound alone made him cringe and bare his teeth. They'd been in the pen for 10 minutes, attempting to get close enough to get him chained down and saddled. If it didn't happen soon, she'd have to go back to the Omega before the yellow legs returned.
He's never taken a saddle, the overseer said to her. Probably won't.
She heard the unspoken words.
I'm not going to risk my men getting it on him. You're just being proud. Pick another mount like a good girl.
Manon flashed her iron teeth at the overseer, her upper lip pulling back just enough to warn him. He backed up a step, whip drooping. Abraxos's mutilated tail slashed across the ground, his eyes never leaving the three men trying to force him into submission. One of them cracked the whip, so close to Abraxos that he flinched away. Another snapped it near his tail, twice. Then Abraxos lunged, with both neck and tail. The three handlers scrambled, barely out of reach of his snapping teeth. Enough.
Your men have cowards' hearts, she said,
giving the overseer a withering look as she stalked across the dirt floor. The overseer grabbed for her, but she slashed with iron-tipped fingers and sliced his hand open. He cursed, but Manon kept walking, licking his blood off her nails,
She almost spat it out. Vile. The blood tasted rotten, as if it had curdled or festered inside a corpse for days. She glanced at the blood on the rest of her hand. It was too dark for human blood. If witches had indeed been killing these men, why had no one reported this? She bit down the questions. She would think about it another time. Maybe drag the overseer into a forgotten corner and open him up to see what was decaying inside him. But right now, the men had gone quiet. Each step brought her closer to Abraxos. A line had been marked in the dirt where the safety of the chains ended. Manon took 3 steps beyond it, one for each face of their goddess. Maiden, mother, crone. Abraxos crouched, the powerful muscles of his body tense, ready to spring. "You know who I am," Manon said, gazing into those endless black eyes, not giving 1 inch to fear or doubt. "I am Manon Blackbeak, heir to the Blackbeak clan, and you are mine. Do you understand?" One of the men snorted, and Manon might have whirled to tear out his tongue right there. But Abraxos lowered his head ever so slightly, as if he understood. "You are Abraxos," Manon said to him, a chill slithering down her neck. "I gave you that name because he is the great beast, the serpent who wrapped the world in his coils, and who will devour it at the very end when the 3-faced goddess bids him to." "You are Abraxos," she repeated, "and you are mine." A blink, then another. Abraxos took a step toward her. Leather groaned as someone tightened their grip on a coiled whip. But Manon held fast, lifting 1 hand toward her wyvern. "Abraxos." The mighty head came toward her, those eyes pools of liquid night meeting her own. Her hand was still extended, tipped in iron and stained with blood. He pressed his snout into her palm and huffed. His gray hide was warm and surprisingly soft, thick but supple, like worn leather. Up close, the variation in color was striking. Not just gray, but dark green, brown, black. It was marred all over by thick scars, so many that they could have been the stripes of a jungle cat. Abraxos's teeth, yellow and cracked, gleamed in the torchlight. Some were missing, but those that remained were as long as a finger and twice as thick. His hot breath reeked, either from his diet or rotting teeth. Each of the scars, the chipped teeth and broken claws, the mutilated tail, they weren't the markings of a victim. Oh, no. They were the trophies of a survivor. Abraxos was a warrior who'd had all the odds stacked against him and survived. Learned from it. Triumphed. Manon didn't bother to look at the men behind her as she said, "Get out." She kept staring into those dark eyes. "Leave the saddle and get out. If you bring a whip in here again, I'll use it on you myself."
"But
now." Muttering and clicking their tongues, the handlers shuffled out and shut the gate. When they were alone, Manon stroked the massive snout. However the king had bred these beasts, Abraxos had somehow been born different. Smaller, but smarter. Or perhaps the others didn't ever need to think. Cared for and trained, they did what they were told. But Abraxos had learned to survive. And perhaps that had opened his mind. He could understand her words, her expressions. And if he could comprehend those things, he could possibly teach the other mounts of the 13. It was a small edge, but an edge that could make them wing leader and make them invincible against the king's enemies.
I am going to put this saddle on you, she said, still cupping that snout. He shifted, but Manon grabbed on tight, forcing him to look at her.
You want out of this shithole? Then you'll let me put this saddle on you to check the fit.
And when we're done,
you're going to let me look at your tail. Those human bastards cut off your spikes, so I'm going to build some for you. Iron ones, like mine, she said, and flashed her iron nails for him to see. And fangs, too, she added, baring her iron teeth. It's going to hurt, and you're going to want to kill the men who put them in, but you're going to let them do it, because if you don't, then you will rot down here for the rest of your life. Understand? A long, hot huff of air into her hands. Once all that is done, she said, smiling faintly at her wyvern, you and I are going to learn how to fly. And then we'll stain this kingdom red.
Abraxos did everything she asked, though he growled at the handlers who inspected and poked and prodded, and nearly bit off the arm of the physician who had to dig out his rotted teeth to make way for the iron fangs. It took 5 days to do it all. He almost took out a wall when they welded the iron spikes onto his tail, but Manon stood with him the entire time, talking to him about what it was like to ride with the 13 on their ironwood brooms and hunt down the Kraken witches. She told the stories as much to distract him as she did to remind the men that if they made a mistake, if they hurt him, her retribution would be a long, bloody process. Not one of them made an error. During the 5 days they worked on him, she missed her riding lessons with the 13. And with each passing day, the window for getting Abraxos airborne became smaller and smaller. Manon stood with Astarin and Sorrel in the training hall, watching the tail end of the day's sparring session. Sorrel had been working with the youngest coven of Blackbeaks, all of them under 70, and few of them experienced.
How bad? Manon asked, crossing her arms.
Sorrel, small and dark-haired, crossed her arms as well. Not as bad as we feared, but they're still sorting out coven dynamics. And their leader is...
Sorrel frowned at a mousy-looking witch who had just been thrown to the ground by an inferior.
I'd suggest either having her coven decide what to do with her, or picking a new leader.
One weak coven in the wing and we could lose the war games. The coven leader was panting on the hard stone floor, nose dripping blue blood.
Manon ground her teeth.
Give her 2 days. Let's see if she sorts herself out. No need to have word of unstable covens get around. But have Vesta take her out tonight, Manon added, glancing to the red-haired beauty leading another coven in archery drills, to wherever she's been going to torment the men in the Northern Fang. Sorrel raised her thick brows innocently, and Manon rolled her eyes.
You're a worse liar than Vesta. You think I haven't noticed those men grinning at her all hours of the day? Or the bite marks on them?
Just keep the death toll down. We have enough to worry about as it is. We don't need a mutiny from the mortals.
Astarin snorted, but when Manon gave her a sidelong look, the witch kept her gaze ahead, face all too innocent. Of course, if Vesta had been bedding and bleeding the men, then Astarin had been right there with her. Neither of them had reported anything about the men tasting strange.
As you will it, lady, Sorrel said, a faint hint of color on her tan cheeks.
If Manon was ice and Astarin was fire, then Sorrel was rock. Her grandmother had told her on occasion to make Sorrel her second, as ice and stone were sometimes too similar. But without Astarin's flame, without her second being able to rile up a host or rip out the throat of any challenger to Manon's dominance, Manon would not have led the 13 so successfully. Sorrel was grounded enough to even them both out. the perfect third.
The only ones having fun right now, Asterin said, are the green-eyed demon twins.
Indeed, the midnight-haired Phalene and Fallon were grinning with maniacal glee as they led three covens in knife-throwing exercises, using their inferiors as target practice. Manon just shook her head. Whatever worked, whatever shook the dust off these blackbeak warriors.
And my shadows? Manon asked Asterin. How are they doing?
Etta and Briar, two cousins that were as close as sisters, had been trained since infancy to blend into any sliver of darkness and listen. And they were nowhere to be seen in this hall, just as Manon had ordered.
They'll have a report for you tonight, Asterin said.
Distant cousins to Manon, the shadows bore the same moon-white hair. Or they had, until they'd discovered 80 years ago that the silver hair was as good as a beacon and dyed it solid black. They rarely spoke, never laughed, and sometimes even Asterin herself couldn't detect them until they were at her throat. It was their sole source of amusement, sneaking up on people, though they'd never dared do it to Manon. It was no surprise they'd taken two onyx wyverns. Manon eyed her second and third.
I want you both in my room for their report, too.
I'll have Lynn and Vesta stand watch, Asterin said.
They were Manon's fallback sentries, Vesta for the disarming smiles, and Lynn because if anyone ever called her by her full name, Linnea, the name her soft-hearted mother had given her before Lynn's grandmother tore out her heart, that person wound up with missing teeth at best, a missing face at worst. Manon was about to turn away when she caught her second and third watching her. She knew the question they didn't dare ask, and said,
I'll be airborne with Abraxos in a week,
and then we'll be flying as one.
It was a lie, but they believed her anyway. Chapter 28 Days passed, and not all of them were awful. Out of nowhere, Rowan decided to take Selena to the Commune of Healers 15 miles away, where the finest healers in the world learned, taught, and worked. Situated on the border between the Fae and mortal world, they were accessible to anyone who could reach them. It was one of the few good things Maeve had done. As a child, Selena had begged her mother to bring her. But the answer had always been no, accompanied by a vague promise that they would someday take a trip to the Torre Chesme in the southern continent, where many of the teachers had been taught by the Fae. Her mother had done everything she could to keep her from Maeve's clutches. The irony of it wasn't wasted on her. So Rowan took her. She could have spent all day, all month, wandering the grounds under the clever, kind eyes of the head healer. But her time there was halved thanks to the distance and her inability to shift, and Rowan wanted to be home before nightfall. Honestly, while she'd actually enjoyed herself at the peaceful Riverside compound, she wondered whether Rowan had just brought her there to make her feel bad about the life she'd fallen into. It had made her quiet on the long hike back. And he didn't give her a moment's rest. They were to set out the following day on an overnight trip, but he wouldn't say where. Fantastic. Already making the day's bread, Emrys only looked faintly amused as Selena hurried in, stuffed her face with food and guzzled down tea, and hurried back out. Rowan was waiting by her rooms, a small pack dangling from his hands. He held it open for her. Clothes, he said. And she stuffed the extra shirt and underclothes she'd laid out into the bag. He shouldered it, which she supposed meant he was in a good mood, as she'd fully expected to play pack mule on their way to wherever they were going. He didn't say anything until they were in the mist-shrouded trees, again heading west. When the fortress walls had vanished behind them, the wardstone zinging against her skin as they passed through. He stopped at last, throwing back the heavy hood of his jacket. She did the same, the cool air biting her warm cheeks.
"Shift, and let's go," he said, his second words to her this morning.
And here I was thinking we'd become friends.
He raised his brows and gestured with a hand for her to shift.
"It's 20 miles,
he said by way of encouragement, and gave her a wicked grin.
"We're running. Each way."
Her knees trembled at the thought of it.
Of course he'd make this into some sort of torture session. Of course.
And where are we going?
He clenched his jaw, the tattoo stretching.
There was another body, a demi-fey from a neighboring fortress, dumped in the same area, same patterns. I want to go to the nearby town to question the citizens, but...
His mouth twisted to the side, then he shook his head at some silent conversation with himself.
But I need your help. It'll be easier for the mortals to talk to you.
Is that a compliment?
He rolled his eyes.
Perhaps yesterday's outing to the healer's compound hadn't been out of spite. Maybe he'd been trying to do something nice for her.
Shift, or it'll take us twice as long.
I can't. You know it doesn't work like that.
Don't you want to see how fast you can run?
I can't use my other form in Otterlin anyway, so what's the point?
Which was the start of a whole massive issue she hadn't yet let herself contemplate.
The point is that you're here now, and you haven't properly tested your limits.
It was true. She hadn't really seen what she was capable of.
The point is, another husk of a body was found, and I consider that to be unacceptable.
Another body. From that creature.
A horrible, wretched death.
It was unacceptable. He gave her braid a sharp, painful tug.
Unless you're still frightened.
Her nostrils flared. The only thing that frightens me is how very much I want to throttle you. More than that, she wanted to find the creature and destroy it, for those it had murdered and for what it had made her walk through. She would kill it. Slowly. A miserable sort of pressure and heat began building under her skin.
Rowan murmured,
"Hone it. The anger."
Was that why he'd told her about the body?
Bastard. Bastard for manipulating her, for making her pull double duty in the kitchen.
But his face was unreadable as he said, "Let it be a blade, Aelin. If you cannot find the peace, then at least hone the anger that guides you to the shift. Embrace and control it. It is not your enemy."
Aerobin had done everything he could to make her hate her heritage, to fear it. What he'd done to her, what she'd allowed herself to become.
"This will not end well," she breathed.
He didn't back down.
"See what you want, Aelin, and seize it. Don't ask for it. Don't wish for it. Take it."
"I'm certain the average magic instructor would not recommend this to most people."
"You are not most people, and I think you like it that way. If it's a darker set of emotions that will help you shift on command, then that's what we'll use. There might come a day when you find that anger doesn't work, or when it is a crutch. But for now..."
A contemplative look.
"It was the common denominator those times you shifted. Anger of varying kinds. So own it."
He was right, and she didn't want to think on it any more than that, or let herself get that enraged, not when she had been so angry for so long. For now. Selena took a long breath, then another.
She let the anger anchor her, a knife slicing past the usual hesitation and doubt and emptiness.
She brushed up against that familiar inner wall. No. A veil shimmering with soft light. All this time, she thought she'd been reaching down for the power.
but this was more of a reach in. Not a wish, but a command. She would shift, because there was a creature prowling these lands, and it deserved to pay. With a silent growl, she punched herself through the veil, pain shooting along every inch and pore as she shifted. A fierce, challenging grin, and Rowan moved, so fast she could hardly follow as he appeared on her other side and yanked on her braid again. When she whirled, he was already gone, and she yelped as he pinched her side. Stop! He was standing in front of her now, a wild invitation in his eyes. She'd been studying the way he moved, his tricks and tells, the way he assumed she'd react. So when she crossed her arms, feigning the tantrum he expected, she waited. Waited, and then he shot left to pinch or poke or hit her, and she whirled, slamming down his arm with an elbow and whacking him upside the head with her other hand. He stopped dead and blinked a few times. She smirked at him. He bared his teeth in a feral, petrifying grin. Oh, you'd better run now. When he lunged, she shot through the trees. She had a suspicion that Rowan was letting her get ahead for the first few minutes, because though she moved faster, she could barely adjust enough to her altered body to leap over rocks and fallen trees. He'd said they were going southwest, and that was where she went, dodging between the trees, the anger simmering away, shifting into something else entirely. Rowan was a silver and white streak beside her and behind her, and every time he got too close, she veered the other way, testing out the senses that told her where the trees were without seeing them. The smell of oak and moss and living things. The open coolness of the mist passing between them like a path that she followed. They hit a plateau, the ground easy beneath her boots. Faster. She wanted to see if she could go faster, if she could outrun the wind itself. Rowan appeared at her left, and she pumped her arms, her legs, savoring the breath in her lungs, smooth and calm, ready to see what she would do next. More. This body wanted more. She wanted more. And then she was going swifter than she ever had in her life, the trees a blur, her immortal body singing as she let its rhythms fall into place. Her powerful lungs gobbled down the misty air and filled with the smell and taste of the world. Only instinct and reflex guiding her, telling her she could go faster still, feet eating up the loamy earth step by step by step. Gods. Oh, gods. She could have flown, could have soared for the sudden surge of ecstasy in her blood, the sheer freedom granted by the marvel of creation that was her body. Rowan shot at her from the right, but she dodged a tree with such ease she let out a whoop, then threw herself between two long-hanging branches, mere hurdles that she landed with feline skill. Rowan was at her side again, lunging with a snap of his teeth, but she whirled and leapt over a rock, letting the moves she'd honed as an assassin blend into the instincts of her fey body. She could die for love of this speed, this surety in her bones. How had she been afraid of this body for so long? Even her soul felt looser, as if she had been locked up and buried, and was only now starting to shake free. Not joy, perhaps not ever, but a glimmer of what she had been before grief had decimated her so thoroughly. Rowan raced beside her, but made no move to grab her. No, Rowan was playing. He threw a glance at her, breathing hard but evenly. And it might have been the sun through the canopy, but she could have sworn that she saw his eyes alight with a glimmer of that same feral contentment. She could have sworn he was smiling. It was the fastest 20 miles of her life. Granted, the last 5 were slower, and by the time Rowan brought them to a halt, they were both gulping down air.
It was only then, as they stared at each other between the trees, that she realized the magic hadn't once flared, hadn't once tried to overpower or erupt. She could feel it waiting down in her gut, warm but calm, slumbering. She wiped the sweat from her brow, her neck, her face. Though she was panting, she still could have run for miles more. Gods, if she had been this fast the night Nehemia had... It wouldn't have made a difference. Nehemia had orchestrated every step in her own destruction, and would have found another way. And she had only done it because Selena refused to help, refused to act. Having this glorious fey body changed nothing. She blinked, realizing she'd been staring at Rowan, and that whatever satisfaction she'd seen on his face had again turned to ice. He tossed something at her, the shirt he'd carried with him. Change. He turned and stripped off his own shirt. His back was just as tan and scarred as the rest of him, but seeing those markings didn't make her want to show him what her own ruined back looked like. So she moved between the trees until she was sure he couldn't see her, and swapped her shirt. When she returned to where he'd dumped the pack, he tossed her a skein of water, which she gulped down. It tasted. She could taste each layer of minerals in the water, and the musk of the skein itself. By the time they strode into the red-roofed little town, Selena could breathe again. They quickly learned that it was almost impossible to get anyone to talk, especially to two fey visitors. Selena debated returning to her human form, but with her accent and ever-worsening mood, she was fairly certain a woman from Otterlin wouldn't be much better received than a fey. Windows were shuttered as they passed, probably because of Rowan, who looked like nothing short of death incarnate. But he was surprisingly calm with the villagers they approached. He didn't raise his voice, didn't snarl, didn't threaten. He didn't smile, but for Rowan, he was downright cheerful. Still, it got them nowhere. No, they had not heard of a missing demi-fey or any other bodies. No, they had not seen any strange people lurking about. No, livestock were not disappearing, though there was a chicken thief a few towns away. No, they were perfectly safe and protected in Wendlin, and didn't appreciate fey and demi-fey poking into their business either. Selena had given up on flirting with a pock-faced stable boy at the inn, who had just gawked at her ears and canines as though she were one heartbeat away from eating him alive. She stalked down the pleasant main street, hungry and tired, and annoyed that they were indeed going to need their bedrolls, because the innkeeper had already informed them he had no vacancies. Rowan fell into step beside her, the storm clouds in his eyes saying enough about how his conversation with the taproom maid had gone. I could believe it was a half-wild creature if at least some of them knew these people had vanished, she mused. But consistently selecting someone who wouldn't be missed or noticed? It must be sentient enough to know who to target. The demi-fey has to be a message, but what?